This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. And I am Greg Phillips. I don't know why there was an "and" at the beginning of that sentence. There was really no need for that "and." But nonetheless, I am Greg Phillips. With me in the L-shaped studio in Ho-Ho Loon Plaza, right here in sunny or cloudy, one of the two, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, is Nick Duke.
Mm.
Nick, my hard-traveling companion, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, sir. I'm doing well. We just got done shouting at each other before the show ever started, so it ought to make for one interesting show.
That's right. If you like Conrad and, I don't know,
Conrad, Eric, Bruce, I guess. Bruce gets half hot, you know. Go ahead and get your chapstick out.
I don't need any chapstick, Nick, because I'm riding on cloud nine right now.
That's harsh.
You're getting ready to
chapstick up and kiss the New York ass of Dan DiDio.
I don't need to kiss Dan DiDio's ass. I'm just sitting back and some men just want to watch the world burn.
Yeah. All right, well, let's...
Rubies the size of tangerines.
Well, on that note, we should probably tell the folks that we're doing things a little different this week.
That's right. You see, here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys, we are nothing if not slavishly loyal to our format.
Typically.
But this week, we're going to shake things up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You see, for the first long while on our show, we always led off with the rundown and reading and watching, and then led into our main event. Now, we switched that up, and we think that it's worked pretty well going the other route with that. But this week, we got such big comic book news that we both felt it appropriate to lead off this week's show with the rundown. Now, this episode, as you will see in the title that you clicked on, is The Long Book Hunters, where we would be talking about New Avengers by Brian Michael Bendis and David Finch. We're still going to be talking about that for Avengers Month. But first, we have to talk about the big news and notes in the world of comics in a segment that we like to call The Rundown. Nick, I can think of no better. Actually, there were a couple of stories, in fairness, that were competing for this top spot.
But yeah, we discussed two in particular.
Right.
So this is this is the one. Arguably, I think the other one we discussed will wind up affecting more people. That's probably inarguable because it involves a movie as opposed to a comic. But this one seems to have, hit a nerve throughout the comics community, both on people who are thrilled by the news like yourself and people who are bummed by the news like many others and people who are kind of somewhere in the middle like me, even if I do lean more towards the bummed side than the thrilled side.
Yes. And to be clear, I'm trying not to be a jerk about this because we talked about this off the air. I don't want to come off like the asshole that shits on something that somebody else really enjoys. However, as we know, I haven't talked about Tom King's Batman run in a long time on the show.
Greg is what the world needs today, though, Greg.
Probably 2 years since I've talked about this run, which I dropped stopped reading.
No, we talked about it at 50. Has that been 2 years ago?
It might have been. It feels like it was last summer.
It was last summer, yes. It's been about a year.
Since I've talked about it. And I dropped the book, and I had dropped it before that and picked up that issue to check it out, and we had that.
But that's kind of when we had the big, that's when we had the big kind of debate about the entire
Right.
You know, the merits of the run at that point.
Yes, yes. And my feeling at the time was I am not committing to a 100-issue run that has not entertained me to this point. Mm-hmm. And in particular, one that promised me something that I felt it did not deliver and that it had no intention to deliver until far down the line. Then he extended his run even more to 106 issues or whatever. And I was like, gosh, I was happy. And I've been fine. I've been content. I'm happy with people that are enjoying that run. I have enjoyed my break from comics as a large result of this and some other factors, which we haven't really talked about much on the show with other storylines going on in the world of comics. But the news that dropped today is that Tom King, who had been planning this 100 and correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was 105, 106.
It's very close to that. I mean, whatever the actual number is.
Yeah.
Let's call it 105 for the sake of simplicity's sake.
Ooh, by the way, we might have another news item to add on to here after we do this. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Yeah, so 106 issues or whatever was Tom King planning to do on his Batman run, allegedly, according to his interviews. Well, the news came out that Tom King will be prematurely ending his Batman run with issue number 85. Mm-hmm. CBR is reporting this. It's pretty much confirmed at this point. What is not confirmed is the reason for this early departure. There are a lot of rumors out there, a lot of rumors and innuendo, even, that about the reasons behind this change. But nonetheless, Tom King will be ending at issue 85, which is roughly 20 issues before when he planned to end his Batman run, which at this point dates back to early 2016 and the Rebirth Initiative.
Yes.
He's had it from since that point.
Is he the only – no, let's see. Josh Williamson is still on Flash.
Yes.
But I think those are the only two, right, that are still around from the beginning of Rebirth?
Yeah, I think that's it. Was Deathstroke a day one Rebirth title? I think that might have started later, right?
I thought it was over now, though.
It might be. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know that it is.
I don't know either. But okay, so we'll count Chris Priest if you want to. But I mean, my point is,
mm-hmm.
of those books, most of them have either ended or have undergone massive.
The writers have moved on to other books.
Yeah,
creative shakeups, relaunches, and all that.
Something like that.
Yeah, this one has stayed consistent the whole time, and now he's leaving the book. And a lot of rumors are flying around about the reasons for this. We will address some of those rumors here with the precursor and the information that we understand that we don't know. Neither of us knows. We don't actually have connected industry sources.
Right. We're not purporting any of what we're going to talk about here. Like, we've gotten the facts out of the way up front. We know that Tom King is leaving the book by the end of the year. If you are annoyed by speculation or rumor, and if you are someone who prefers to wait for official corporate-led communication from DC or a statement from Tom King, then just go ahead and skip this part of the podcast. Really what this is about is talking about this as a larger topic, both in the context of his run and kind of the larger goings-on at DC Comics over the last year or so.
Yes.
So if that annoys you, just skip ahead would be the best advice I can give you.
So there are two kind of predominant theories right now that are kind of – and really I don't think they're independent.
No, we discussed this earlier. I think they're pretty – I don't think you can have – I mean, you go ahead and lay them out if you're going to say what I think you're about to say.
So one aspect is that the sales on Batman have been dropping at what DC considers to be a concerning rate for Batman, which is their top-selling character by far. Here are some numbers with regards to Batman. So according to Comicron.com, which is the only consistent – sales website that I know of. And again, in comics, we can't track. Mm-hmm. We don't have a way right now that I'm aware of tracking how many issues actually sell to customers. This is how many orders go to comic book shops. Right. So I'm going to pull up March of this year, the most recent numbers that we have on Comicron. We're going to compare those to March a year ago, and see how that compares. I've got a – I had this up earlier, and then I took it down. Now I'm pulling it back up. So year to year drop for Batman. A year ago, Batman number 42 sold 93,825 copies. Batman number 43 sold 91,649 copies. And that month, Batman was the number five book behind Dark Knight's Metal, Doomsday Clock, Amazing Spider-Man, which had an event book, and Weapon H, number one, which was a
good
number one.
Lord, are you serious?
I can't explain it.
Okay. So basically, what was ahead of Batman at this juncture, event titles and new gimmicks of the month, essentially.
Correct.
Okay.
And similar story here, by the way.
Yes.
Because this month, sales of Batman were 84,463.
Recent month?
Yes. This is Batman 67.
A drop of roughly 7,000 books.
Year to year, yep. Okay. And then 83,000 for 66. On top of it is Detective Comics 1000.
Yeah, obviously.
Which moved 526,000, a lot of units on that. And then you drop way off for number two at Batman Who Laughs, Doomsday Clock, and then you go to Batman.
So, yeah.
So DC is, you know, doing pretty well at the top there. But yeah, so now the other issue is let's take it back a little bit farther than that. Let's go back to the beginning of Tom King's run in March of 2016.
Okay.
This was the end of Scott Snyder's run. My bad. Batman 50. So that's an event book. We won't count that. March of 2017, Batman is selling 98,000.
And that's what?
And 97,000. And that's March of 2017.
But what issues of the run?
18 and 19.
Okay.
And then you go back, instead of taking Batman 50, let's go to Batman 49, which I think was January of 2016 from Tom King. Yeah, Batman 48 in January of 16 moved 101,000 copies, essentially. So I think the reason that I bring up all these boring numbers is that I believe DC was concerned about the dropping sales on Batman on this long run. But that's not the only issue. The other issue that we're talking about coinciding with this, and probably equally as important, if not more so, is that Tom King has indicated he was preparing, in his final issues of Batman, a status quo shift that would affect the character for years, if not generations to come. What was this status quo shift? I don't know.
No one does.
I know. Nick, you speculated that it could have been the marriage of Batman and Catwoman. I wonder if it might have been something even more extensive than that. What that could be, I don't know. But certainly the marriage could have been back on the table for that. And I would hope, by the way, that that was the end game of this run. Especially after the fiasco of 50 and the fallout of that, no matter which side of that you fell on, certainly, I would hope that the end result would be some sort of reconciliation between those two characters, Batman and Catwoman. However, apparently over the weekend at this conference, something happened. Maybe he pitched that idea to the wrong person and somebody got cold feet. I don't know.
Yeah, because he had been talking about it in media interviews as recently as a week ago. I know he gave an interview to the Hollywood Reporter where he talked about those plans to do something massive and status quo altering to the character. And he mentioned in that interview having to sit down with executives from DC, from Warner Brothers, and even from new parent company, AT&T, who now owns Warner Brothers, which means they own DC Comics. And he mentioned at that point that, shockingly, he had been given approval to do these things. So I think he had kind of passed the pitch phase based on my understanding of my reading of the interviews and stuff.
It's very interesting, to say the least, of how this all came together. Now, why do we think that the two theories are intertwined with one another and not independent issues? Well, let's look at this and take one without the other. If – Tom King had a story idea that was so status quo shaking that it would essentially break Batman, who has been called the unbreakable character before by many creators. Mm-hmm. We have witnessed in DC, in of all places, the ease with which a company, one of these big two superhero companies, can just hand wave away any mm-hmm. changes to a character.
Yes.
They do it all the time.
Yep.
Hell, they just aged up John Kent in the Superman books to yep. a teenager not too long ago. So it can be done easily. Hal Jordan murdered.
Literally murdered his entire supporting cast.
Supporting cast.
And on panel. It. And years yep. later, they just fixed it.
Mm-hmm. It can be done.
Yes.
And so if the book was still selling 95 to 100,000 copies a month mm-hmm. and dominating the sales charts, which is still on top right now, but if it was still moving copy at the same rate that it was, I don't think you have this conversation. Now, on the other hand, if it can't be strictly a financial decision.
No.
Because if it's strictly a financial decision, that doesn't make any sense. Because look at all the other books in DC that aren't selling worth a diddly poo.
Yes.
I would argue most.
If we're gonna start
books,
if we're gonna start firing writers or pulling writers off titles who aren't selling 90,000 copies, let's pull literally the entire DC Comics editorial staff off their books.
I mean, hell, what is even Detective Comics moving right now? I don't even know.
Well, it's had 1,000, so I mean, you can't. You almost got.
Well, yeah, good point. Yeah, never mind. But okay, let's go down the. I'm trying to find a comparable. Okay, well, Green Lantern's moving 47,325. It's pretty good numbers for Green Lantern. But something else I realized on here before the New 52, Green Lantern was DC's number one book,
mm-hmm.
moving 93,000 copies in March of 2009. So. Going down here, Catwoman, 43,000, The Flash, 39,000, 38,000 for a character that has TV exposure. Wonder Woman, not moving a ton of copies right now. Supergirl, not moving a ton of copies right now. So it can't just be a financial decision. And I think it also can't be just a creative decision. Yes. It could be, I suppose. But I think if you combine the two, the picture becomes a little clearer on why. Now, reactions to this are all over the board. A lot of people, like myself, tuned out of Tom King's run for various reasons, whether it was issue 50, whether it was the pacing of the story, whether it was kind of repeating story threads from the past, perceived-wise, whatever. People, a substantial, not the majority, but a substantial group of people backed out of this run, not for them. A more substantial group of people love this run, adore it. And now I don't know how many people are just buying Batman because they're going to buy Batman regardless. But a lot of people love this run. A lot of people think it's great. Some people call it an all-time run. So you've got people on both sides of the fence. Admittedly, I'm on the former. I am not a Tom King fan, so it's... To me, it's not a bad thing that I'm going to see a new writer take over and institute their vision, and it gives me hope that perhaps the Rick Grayson thing will end as well. Who knows? Maybe not. But on the other hand, you had other fans that were invested in this ride that are waiting for a conclusion that will feel satisfactory, and now, apparently, based on what we know, whether, you know, Tom King could contradict this in a few days, but what we know now is it seems like he's going to have to cut that run short and accelerate this ending that he's been building to. One comment I would make is maybe if you could almost plan for this possibility if you accelerated your storytelling a bit in the first place, but that's just my take on his run. So, now that run's getting cut short by 20 issues. People are up in arms about this. They don't like it. And it is certainly never a good thing when a writer gets, or an artist, but particularly a writer, gets his promised or supposedly promised storyline pulled back or pulled out from under him.
Supposedly promised.
But on the other hand, this is not anything new in comics. It's gone on since comics have started. I mean, to my knowledge, Nick, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know that there is any writer that's had 100-plus consecutive issues of Batman, the main Batman title.
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Certainly Scott Snyder didn't get that many issues.
Now, the one thing that complicates the nature of this discussion in terms of the length of the run is Batman, for the vast majority of its publishing history, has not been a bi-monthly title.
Yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Greg, but weren't, during the early days of Rebirth, weren't they shipping those bi-monthly books at $2.99 and a lower page count? Like something like 20 pages as opposed to 24 pages?
22 or something like that. Yeah, yeah, something like that.
So, I mean, like, it still comes out to more a month than you would get of most titles, but it wasn't like
– yes.
It wasn't like getting two actual what you consider to be, quote, standard length books.
Not far off,
but I'm saying there was
more
a slight,
issues
slight distance
of story. Yeah, more issues of story than – Any writer I can recall. I'm not saying that – certainly Denny O'Neil has probably written more than 100 Batman comics in his day, but consecutively and telling one complete tapestry, it's very rare. We saw Geoff Johns get a run like this on Green Lantern, not this many issues, but he got a very long run on Green Lantern. We saw Brian Bendis on Ultimate Spider-Man get – how many issues did he get combined with Miles and Peter?
Brian Bendis?
Yeah.
Over 200, well over 200.
Yeah, and that's in an imprint. You know, that's not on the Marvel or on the Spider-Man 616 book.
Yes,
right?
No. I mean, like if you are a Ultimate Spider-Man purist, the way I am, you kind of count Bendis's run as from Ultimate Spider-Man 1 all the way up through. I mean, he wrote Miles' solo series after Miles was introduced into the 616 universe. So,
I'm talking about the flagship Spider-Man titles from Marvel.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing Spider-Man. I mean,
Stan.
Yeah, other than Stan.
Yeah, I was going to say Stan was on it for quite some time.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know the numbers.
Straczynski was on it for a while, certainly a long while. But my point being, and his run didn't end the way he wanted it to, you know, with Spider-Man.
Bill Finger apparently wrote the book for more than 160 issues.
Wow. It took him a long time to get the credit for that too.
Yeah, it did.
And again, they weren't telling one cohesive story.
Right.
It was kind of
was
in those days.
A different time. Yeah.
But yeah, so I don't know, Nick. I'm kind of two minds about it because on the one hand, I did not like this run and did not like what this run kind of the new status quo it set for Batman. Not the new status quo, but the kinds of changes that he instituted, for the most part, I wasn't interested in because I felt like I had seen many of these things done before better and in a more interesting fashion. But that's just my take. Again, my take on the story. And on the other hand,
Don't worry about stuff. Nobody listens to the show anyway.
And on the other hand,
guessing yourself the entire time.
Well, I thought it sucked. I'll be honest. I thought
there.
It sucked.
Thank
Batman
you.
Sucked.
Just be honest.
There. So, and that goes down to a lot of things. But I was willing to give it many chances and come back for 50 and was let down by that, which I thought was largely doo doo. And but then a lot of people love it. So DC, on the other hand, I don't like seeing them cut creators. You know, you brought up a good point that if I was invested in this run. Mm-hmm. I would feel very upset about having it cut short. I absolutely would, because I would want to see the writer get the conclusion that he wants to. Now, my other feeling on that is I don't believe it should take you one. I think you can tell a long form story and have an ending,
yes,
like you're right off into the sunset moment, but it should not take you this long to get somewhere. You can't deconstruct Batman for 100 issues, in my opinion.
I would mostly agree with that. However, my standpoint on it is that's fine. You know, he probably could tell his story in 75 or 80 issues or whatever. But my thing is, if he was told, and I think you would even agree that the overwhelming likelihood is that he was told he could have the 100 issues, and then he asked for six more. And was told he could have that as well. So I'm not going to blame him for pacing his story for 105 issues if he was told that he was going to be writing 105 issues. Like,
right.
I believe he would have paced his story differently. Like, if DC came to him and told him, I think by the end of the year, what's the rumor, that he's going to leave at 85? If DC told him, hey, you got 85 issues, I think he would pace his story completely differently.
You could be right about that. You may be right about that. Here's my comparison that I would make it to. Tom King. Scott Snyder got 50 issues on Main Batman, plus annuals, the weird Villains Month stuff, you know, on his new 52 run. And I think you would agree probably that he told a what feels like a complete story for Batman over the course of that run.
Yes.
In that run, there were many complete stories. So not many, but many. Mm-hmm. So in other words, the Court of Owls is a complete story. Mm-hmm. What was the Joker one where he comes back as the mechanic or whatever? And
Death of the Family.
Death of the Family. Yeah, that one is a complete story.
Right.
The Zero Year, which is a pretty long arc, which is like three arcs wrapped in one, still feels like a complete story. The issue that I've had with Tom King is that it feels like it literally feels like it's a never-ending, like, ongoing story that, like, there is no sense of closure to anything. Every story that I read from him, it just felt so like that's it. Like he gets his back cracked or whatever, and then heals himself, and then climbs out, and that's it. And we just leave that thread hanging, and then it comes back later, certainly. But it just it felt so, I guess, glacial is a way that I would describe it. Where I just felt like nothing of import was really happening, and then you get like moments of shock and swerves and stuff like that, where you have the Rick Grayson stuff and all that, which I wasn't reading at the time.
To be fair, Rick Grayson of it all largely took place in the pages of Nightwing.
Yes, but the actual event was in Batman.
The shooting was
shot by KG Beast, I believe.
Yes.
So, and that may have been great for all I know.
No,
but
I haven't read it, so I wouldn't know.
Again, I think that there is something to be said for picking up the pace at a certain point. And you know, and again, I saw this on Twitter from somebody that it would say a long needed deconstruction of Batman. I would argue that every writer that does Batman in the modern era deconstructs him. Morrison did it. Snyder did it. That was his whole run, was a deconstruction and reconstruction of Batman. Everybody does that. So it's not anything fresh or new. But I think that another guy, Morrison had, when you combine Batman Inc., he probably had close to this run.
Yes.
But again, it wasn't the main title the whole time. So I think that's
an interesting argument, because he wrote Batman for the majority of his run, and then he wrote Batman and Robin, which was kind of treated for that era as the main title, because Batman was written by Tony Daniel, and I think everybody would acknowledge that during that run they were treating Batman and Robin as the main title. Batman Inc. was never treated as the main title.
Yes,
but
Batman Inc. was treated like a redheaded stepchild.
Like it didn't exist.
Like Jason Todd.
Yes.
It was treated like his version of Jason Todd. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying is, would I like to see Tom King get a chance to finish his story? Absolutely.
I don't believe you.
That. Well, no. I think his fans deserve that. Do I necessarily think that needs to be in the main Batman title? No. I don't. I don't believe that Tom King is entitled, as I put it before the show started. And don't get me wrong, I'm sure he was told that he was going to get 106 issues. But I don't think you can – unless you are doing something to that character from a business standpoint that is unprecedented, like making a book like Green Lantern or Aquaman, or I'm trying to think of a Marvel equivalent, or rejuvenating a book like The Incredible Hulk and making it a top five book, I don't know that you can reasonably expect to get that many issues on the main Batman book, no matter what you're told. And it sucks because that's cynical to think about for the comic book industry, but they hate change. They hate status quo changes. They hate...
So then I ask you, how are you supposed to plot a long-term story if you're supposed to Well, always believe that the rug's going to be pulled out from under you.
You can plot – again, the issue – you can plot along – it's hard to do that. You can't – you certainly can't – if you have a long-term story you got and you're planning on sprinkling bits here and there to get to your end that you want to get to, that can be – the rug can be pulled out from under you. Absolutely. However, you can still tell a long story without it being incredibly slow-paced. You can do that. It can be done. It has been done.
Sure.
And that's – I still feel like it comes down – part of this blame lies in the feet of Tom King and his approach to telling this story. And part of it lies in DC – a large part of it lies in DC Comics marketing for the whole Batman 50 fiasco, which we talked about a year ago. And then a third part lies with DC for – and I guess this will be a nice segue into the next part of this conversation. DC appears from the outside looking in, because I'm not reading comics right now. I'm reading Doomsday Clock, and that's about it. But it appears that DC Comics has no real
direction.
Yeah. It feels like if they do have a direction, that they have run away from the direction of Rebirth, and now they are embracing a new direction. That they will then move on from at an undetermined time before it's seen to completion. As a fan, what reason is there to believe that DC Comics, from a publishing standpoint, that DC Comics is actually going to care about you, is actually going to fulfill its promises corporately to the fan base? Because they certainly didn't with Rebirth. They have completely made that clear in the last calendar year that the promise of Rebirth is over. And so what is this next thing? I don't know. But it feels right now as chaotic as it has felt in some time, which is so weird given what DC looked like just 2 years ago when they were snatching up talent left and right from Marvel. Mm-hmm. They were on a run of fan goodwill that they had not experienced in the better part of a decade. And it's what a shit show it has turned into, Nick.
Yes, it is the equivalent of WCW from, you know, going from where they were in the middle of 97 to where they were in the middle of 99. You know, like, it has turned, and it has turned quickly. And that has been my thing ever since this news broke earlier today. Is it if it were just this in a vacuum, it would be the nature of the discussion would be completely differently. I probably wouldn't be as negative on it and as down on it as I am. But when you place it in the larger context of Geoff Johns no longer being in a creative position of power at the company, when you place it in the larger context of you know, something we haven't talked about on the show intentionally because we haven't been reading the story.
Right.
And we don't want to, you know, delve into these waters too deeply, but, you know, we might as well come out and say it. Heroes in Crisis has been not well received by, and I would argue, I think the majority is probably.
Yes,
angry
I believe
about this.
I believe that to be a fair statement.
And it's crazy because they're written, you know, this Batman run is written by the same writer who, of course, is writing this Heroes in Crisis thing.
And it's funny, you talk about Heroes in Crisis, which is an event. And again, I looked at the sales numbers for March of 2019, the most recent that we have. Mm-hmm. Heroes in Crisis only moved 78,000 copies.
Right.
Issue number 7. So it's not captivating people in a way that, for whatever reason, the Batman Who Laughs stuff has.
Or I think War of the Realms is on
top. War of the Realms is doing very well. Yeah. So it's War of the Realms and the Batman Who Laughs are right now the dominant forces in this industry.
Yes.
And Doomsday Clock is still moving really good. But yeah, so Heroes in Crisis has been very, let's just say, controversial.
So you combine that with the constant, you know, you have the resetting of relaunching of titles, cancellation of certain titles. Ben Percy went through a similar thing to Tom King when he was kind of inexplicably pulled from Green Arrow, if you remember.
That right, was I remember that, yep.
Yep. And that's not nearly as notable because Green Arrow is not as high-profile a character as Batman. Ben Percy hadn't said he was doing 100 issues or whatever, but he clearly had a long-form story for that book and then was told, nope, not happening. Why? Well, Dan DiDio has teased big things for Green Arrow involving the DC Universe going forward, and we know he's part of that Leviathan event to be written by Brian Michael Bendis. But my point is, there have been disconcerting bits of news that have been coming out of DC Comics for the better part of what feels like a year now. I remember a few months back we talked about on the show the rumors that DC was going to cut its publishing line back, that they were going to refocus on, you know, what was the number that was thrown around, Greg? Just 22 titles a month or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
And they have slashed their publishing line pretty heavily. They have overhauled, at the very least, their creative strategy, and what seems like is they're overhauling their publishing strategy as well. There were talent layoffs. There were rumors that executive-level layoffs would be occurring, and then that didn't happen. Dan DiDio remains in power somehow. You know, a thousand years from now, when the cockroaches have inherited the earth, Dan DiDio will still be running DC Comics. So you place this in the context of all that, and it just lends itself to this belief of, like, what happened? Like, what happened a year into Rebirth that made all of this go so wrong so quickly?
I have no idea, Nick. It is so fascinating because it's not – at times in comics history when there's been a rut like this in one company or the other, it often is due to or partially due to a huge creative outburst from the competitor.
Right.
Not so. Marvel's not setting the world on fire right now. Nobody is really singing the praises of Marvel.
I'll tell you, Marvel's getting better from where they were a few years ago. They've started to find their way. But DC had a legitimate opportunity. Because even when the New 52 happened, Marvel kind of had its shit together for the most part back in 2012? 2011, 2012. So DC was able to in terms of a very short term, overtake Marvel for the sales lead. And then gave it right back because Marvel was a juggernaut. It still is. But Marvel, 2-3 years ago when Rebirth started, was on shaky ground for the first time in a long time. We had Secret Empire that was pissing everyone off. We had, you know, new titles and legacy characters, and nobody seemed to know what Marvel's long-term direction was. It felt like Marvel was becoming increasingly distanced from, you know, the stories and the characters that made Marvel Marvel. And DC had a legitimate opportunity, I thought, for the first time in, God, Greg, 2 decades, to make a legitimate run at the number one spot. And there for a year, it seemed like they were well poised to usher in what was going to be one of the greatest creative periods in the company's history. And instead, it all fell apart, and fell apart fast, it seems.
And, you know, this is coming from somebody that, by the way, speaking of sales anomalies, Venom is the number one selling monthly title for Marvel now.
I have heard nothing but good things about Venom. I'll put it that way.
Oh, I have too. Russell is saying it's crazy. It just shocks me that the business has accompanied that. It's moving 84,000, and that's the top seller month to month, it looks like, for Marvel right now, and followed by Amazing Spider-Man. But it's just like, regardless of the business, just from a creative standpoint, I've not been as excited about comics as I was that year following Rebirth, probably since I was a kid, just from a line-wide perspective. It was so refreshing. People were getting into comics and reading comics for the first time, a lot of people. And all of that goodwill seems like it cratered. It seems like they panicked at some point, perhaps over the doomsday clock delays. I don't know what the story was with all that, still don't. But whatever the reason was, they lost faith in that vision that Geoff Johns laid out clearly and decided to move on probably around the time that Bendis was brought in. And then they were stuck kind of like, okay, well, what's our new direction? Okay, well, let's get a brand new direction coming from Scott Snyder and Josh Williamson. But in the process of all of this, they have undermined and seemingly undermined and cut the legs out from under so many different people, writers, artists that are on some of these iconic characters, Green Arrow, Aquaman before, Wonder Woman a few times, and just and kind of left people holding. Even Tomasi and Gleason were getting taken off of Superman because they brought in Bendis. Obviously, you bring in Brian Bendis, you give him whatever book he wants. Mm-hmm. But again, that is another example, I think, of a team that had more stories in their quiver.
And so as a result, you know, I don't think that was a direct result. Patrick Gleason just left.
Patrick Gleason's gone. Yeah. And that's a loss for DC. And so I'm in the same boat, man. And I hate to be – when we started this whole venture way back in – we were doing the column in 2013. I wanted something that would be more about the things that we like in the world of comics, because there's so much negative, especially at that time, there was so much negative out there. But gosh, man, I feel like it's come around full circle, because I'm so cynical right now towards particularly superhero comics. This is, I don't want to lump in Image and, you know, creator owned works and all of this.
We discussed the big two on this show for the most part.
Corporate superhero comics right now. I am so, the way I compared it to you earlier, I used two comparisons. One is when I was a kid and I reached that point. We've talked about on the show many times. I reached that point in the late 90s where I realized that nothing really mattered in superhero comics. None of these story decisions ultimately make a difference because they can just hand wave them away. When Ben Reilly was dusted and revealed to be the clone, even though they told us explicitly that he was the real Peter Parker, Onslaught, the, you know, kind of diminishing returns in the Superman books, Kyle Rayner and Evil Parallax and all that stuff, I wasn't into it. And I sort of realized that, wait a minute, all these stories that I've invested all these years of my childhood into, they don't matter. They're not going to make any difference. Everything's just going to return to the way it was. And there was that point where it broke me as a reader for a while. And I was like 12 at that time. So 5 years later, I got back into comics. I knew what I knew now. I knew how it worked. And I was fine with it. And I embraced it. Well, now I've reached another point where I feel like my cynicism has reached a point where I've realized that the products that these companies are pumping out, A, are not really aimed at me. And B, are not giving me what I want out of my entertainment dollars. And so I'm so cynical right now. I don't want to invest in a comic book run. I mean, the idea of investing in 100 comic book issues at this point is just terrifying to me, because I think of all the money I spent over the last 2 years buying books I wasn't even reading.
And see,
and I hate to say that because I love comics. It's not the medium at all. I love comics. And I love these writers and artists.
You would feel completely differently about that if the right story came along. And that's the thing. I've fallen behind on my books as well. And yes, my own laziness and my own other interests, honestly, are a part of that. But I would argue there was a time, the entire time, Greg, that we've done either the column or this podcast, there's always been times where, you know, you or I were struggling to keep up with our monthly books.
Right.
But it happened, and we got caught up, often because there were one or two books that legitimately we could not wait to read, that we were so excited about. And I don't think that that's – like, I don't think that we've become wiser to the nature of the superhero game. We knew it then, just like we know it now. The fact is there were stories that inspired us or made us feel something and excited us to a degree that we didn't care about that. We were able to overcome it. And I think for the most part at both companies, there is a severe lack of that at the moment. The only book I can tell you I feel that way about currently – in terms of an ongoing anyway, is Jason Aaron's Thor, which I'm behind on, but, you know, I'm behind because I'm behind on all comics. And, like, I have every intention of reading every issue of that once I can sit down and carve out the time. Doomsday Clock, from a limited perspective, would also be on that list. And then, you know, Tom King's Batman was certainly one of those that I was enjoying it very much. Was I enjoying it enough to sustain my larger interest in comics as a whole? No, but I was enjoying the story. And I was one of those people who, when I think the turning point of this entire story is Batman 50, because you had expressed your concerns with the run prior to Batman 50, and you know, we've talked about that here on the show before. And there had been pockets, I would say, of people who didn't like what was going on, but there are always pockets of people who don't like what's going on for every run. Batman 50 was so divisive, and I think you genuinely lost so many people after that that had no intention of coming back. But those who stuck around largely for two reasons. One, Batman 50, whether you disagree with the creative decision that is made near the end of that title or not, I still think it's a well-written book. And I think there were people who were invested enough that they wanted to see how this fairly well-crafted Batman story was going to play out. And also, there were people who bought Batman 50 who genuinely believed Tom King when he said, this is not the end. There is a larger, this is the midpoint of the story. We're going somewhere with this. We are taking it somewhere. And you had a little bit of faith because you were enjoying the run that whatever that endpoint was going to make the events of Batman 50 better in context. And now, everything that's happened in his run prior to this, I am concerned, is essentially going to be all for naught. And yes, I understand you can say, well, all superhero stories are for naught because they're eventually ignored anyway. I'm not talking about in terms of influencing larger continuity. I'm talking about in terms of when people make a financial investment, a time investment, or an emotional investment in something, expecting a payoff, even if they are willing to wait for that payoff, you have to deliver it. And I am concerned that DC Comics, like you were saying earlier, the book is down 16, 20,000 copies or whatever at various points. But how many of those 85 or whatever number, 1,000 people who are still buying the title are going to be turned off by this decision? How many do you stand to lose from this? You have asked people to make a massive buy-in. Not just Tom King. DC, by agreeing to publish the story as is, has asked people for this massive buy-in. And now, at least on the surface, it would seem that buy-in was all for naught.
Yeah.
And I think that is my issue. And we mentioned a little while ago, you brought up Pat Gleason. Tom King is still under an exclusive contract with DC Comics. He doesn't get to just automatically walk away from that because of what happened here. I would be stunned if he doesn't leave DC within the next 2 years.
If he does, my advice to him, as someone that's never worked in comics, don't pitch a 100-issue story. Just kidding. Just kidding.
And but, I think this will hurt DC in the short term, for the next year or so, when it comes to creator acquisitions, when it comes to signing talent. Big-name talent especially is going to look at them and say, well, what the hell happened with Tom King? And if there's not a satisfactory answer, why sign? If you don't think that the publisher is going to have your back creatively, why sign?
Don't know. Of course, we should mention that the artist on Tom King's book, Mitch Gerrits, has tweeted out a few times now indicating that people are jumping to conclusions, already putting hints as to what he and Tom King's next big DC project is. So we don't know where all of that stands, but certainly the topic kind of crystallizes a lot of the ongoing problems right now. And comics are not, my perception from the outside looking in, as someone that's not really reading month to month anymore, comics, looking at these numbers and looking at just the general vibe of fans, I don't think the superhero comics are doing great right now. And I could be way off on that. But I get the impression that there's just not a lot of excitement right now in the world of comics. And I know Jonathan Hickman's coming back and doing X-Men. A lot of people are excited about that. Yeah. I know Bendis is getting ready for this big DC event, Leviathan. with the year of the was it Year of the Villain or
Year of the Villain,
Year of the Villain stuff. So there are things going on, and some of those things might even be good. But man, it just, I don't know, man. I get the impression that there's a lot of drama going on at DC. I get the impression that there's nothing right now going on, it seems, that is lighting the comic book industry on fire from a business standpoint. I don't know about creatively because I'm not reading the books. And I'm not really compelled. I've told you on the show I would be interested in reading Bendis's Lois Lane comic, but am I compelled enough to go and buy it?
Is he writing right now? That?
Not or the not Bendis, sorry, Greg Rucka.
That's right, yeah, Rucka.
Just as good. So I really would like to read that, but do I have faith that I would actually read it if I bought it? No, because I have a bunch of comics that I was enjoying Robert Venditti's Green Lantern, but I just stopped reading it because I felt like I didn't have time. And if it was something I was that invested in, I would make time for it.
Like that's what I was about to say. It's not that you didn't have time.
Shitty,
it's that
shitty episodes of Monday Night Raw.
Yeah, we each have other interests that compete for that time. And yeah. A few years ago, comics were holding up favorably in that competition.
Correct.
They're not right now, across the board. Like. And I make no apologies for that. It doesn't make me any less a fan of the art form.
No.
Like, it's not me that's failing the art form. The art form is failing me right now. That's the difference. Like, I'm not going to sacrifice my time with my other interests, whether that be my family.
Or your money.
Professional wrestling, video games, movies. I mean, like, there's so many other options right now for my entertainment dollar. And honestly, we live in a golden age where if I want superhero entertainment, hell, I don't have to pick up a comic ever to get more of it than I can possibly digest in a given week.
I was about to say, for the cost of, let's say, 2-3 Avengers comics, I can go and watch Endgame again.
Yep.
On a matinee. And to me, it's a better investment of time.
Or for the cost of 2 Avengers comics, I can get a subscription to Marvel Unlimited and literally read thousands of comics I've never read before.
Precisely.
Are they brand new? No, but they're new to me.
I was dropping well in excess of $100 a month on comics for a long time. And that money now is going is either going into my bank account or it's going to see Endgame 3 times, which I've done now, or going to a wrestling event, going to AEW Fight for the Fallen in Jacksonville, you know, going to see Mick Foley and Dothan. Yeah, things that, and these are things that are opportunities that give me more bang for my buck. We've talked about that on the podcast before. So it's the time from your standpoint, but for me, it's also the money. It's the idea of, that is a tangible benefit.
It's investment, no matter what. I mean, it's you have a finite amount of resources, whether it's time, money, or emotion, to sink into something. You have to make your choices where you are going to invest those three things. And yes, we've talked about before how $4 for a 20-page for a 30-page comic or whatever is not a great deal, man. It can't compare favorably. And yet, if the stories are good enough, we have paid it. And we have paid it gladly. Like, none of us ever complained a single time plunking down $4 an issue for Geoff Johns' Green Lantern.
Right.
None of us ever complained a single time plunking down $4 an issue for Scott Snyder's Batman run. There are runs, there are books, there are stories that can be told here that are absolutely well and above in excess of the investment they require. I don't think that either of the big two is providing those to me right now.
Yeah, I was just on Facebook today. It reminded me that 6 years ago was the release of the last issue of Geoff Johns' 80-plus issue Green Lantern run. And the excitement and the joy and the dread that we all went into that last issue with. And you know, there are – I told this to you as well during one of our offline conversations today that I miss feeling that way about a comic book, that a comic book could make me feel the way that I felt going into Endgame or the way that I felt watching Kofi Kingston and Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania. You know, just that emotional investment, and I haven't felt that in a long time now in comics, and I know part of that is because I stopped reading. But even when I was reading, they had stopped. There were some good stories I was reading, but they weren't must see.
Right.
They weren't drop everything else. That feeling that you'd get. Remember when it would be like a Tuesday night? We're like, well, tomorrow's the day. You know, that issue comes out. I have to get it in my hands. I can't wait to read it. And I haven't had that in a long time. And I hate to say that.
Absolutely. Now, I hate to run the risk of extending this discussion even further, but there's one other aspect of it that we've mentioned, but we haven't really touched on it. Does the AT&T of this concern you at all? Here's the reason I ask. Years ago, when I was in college, I want to say it was, 2006 or 7, when Disney acquired Marvel. And I remember at the time, as a Marvel – at that point, I was reading far more Marvel than I was DC, being concerned that this was going to represent the end of Marvel as I knew it, that it was going to usher in an era of corporate oversight and interference, and that Marvel stories would now be dictated to them by a larger corporate entity that had no real understanding of what it was that Marvel Comics did. I was equating it to something like, you know, AOL Time Warner having control of WCW when they had no interest in understanding in what that company did. And largely, for the most part, I believe that's proven not to be the case. Disney kind of understands Marvel for what it is. To Disney, Marvel is an IP farm, and they give them the license to go out and create IP and fresh content for Disney, and Disney takes that content and monetizes it on a scale that published comics are incapable of doing. For the most part, you have not heard any stories of Disney corporate interfering with Marvel's publishing or editorial plans. The AT&T Warner Brothers acquisition closed not that long ago, within the last 6 months. And when I hear that Tom King is having to have sit-downs with AT&T about the creative direction of a story, and I can't recall hearing that happen one time in 12 years for a Marvel story, that sets off every red alert possible in my mind. The last thing that DC Comics needs after years under Warner Brothers' purview is more overly reactionary executives who do not understand what it is that DC Comics does.
Right. I think there is an argument to be made that maybe they do need somebody from – maybe comics in general needs an outsider to come in and tell them, hey, you've run your business like shit for 35 years. Here's how you rebuild it. But certainly AT&T making creative decisions is not a good thing. And that's certainly not a good thing at all. Here's another aspect, Nick, before we leave this topic that I want to bring up. Let's go back to 2007 and the Spider-Man book that led to, of course, One More Day. We've been over that a billion times on this show. One of the more, for you, infuriating comic book decisions that has been made, right?
Yes, absolutely.
What if Tom King had something similar in plan for Batman? We don't know what this idea was. What if his status quo idea was a bad one?
We don't know.
What if he came with an idea that was so out of this world that somebody heard it and said, yo, we'd be doing major damage control on this? Could you envision that being a scenario that happened?
I could, but I would offer this, and they've even teased this in the last year or so. If Marvel's editorial board decided tomorrow that they wanted to undo the events of One More Day, they would just do that. They would come up with a reason, they would come up with an excuse, and we would have the Peter Mary Jane marriage restored 3 months from now. If they really wanted it that way, it could happen. I don't think that there's anything I do not believe that there is anything you can do to any character that can honestly, permanently, fundamentally break them. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One, retcons have become so prevalent in the industry that they can happen at any time, and they don't even really have to make sense anymore. And I say that also because, and we discussed this earlier today, I often think that the comics decision makers and even the companies that control the comics publishing houses themselves overestimate the influence of actual printed comics in today's day and age. My point being, let's pull something out of our ass. Let's say that Tom King's Batman run was going to end with Batman
picking up a gun and shooting Bane in the head.
Picking up a gun and shooting Bane in the head and then blowing up a school. Let's take it to this far-reaching degree. The numbers you just quoted earlier, it's going to be the end of a run. Let's say that book sells 100,000 copies, right? 100,000 mm-hmm. people read that book. Let's say there are more people like you or I who don't buy the book but are absolutely following the story from afar. Let's say that there's 500,000 people following it that way. And let's say there are another 500,000 people who aren't really necessarily following it, but maybe they hear about it on the internet or something. You know, they're consumers of pop culture to a degree that they might read a headline or something like that. That, oh, Batman just blew up a school.
Mm-hmm.
That's 1,000,000 people in this planet, on this planet, who are now aware of what you've done with this character. Batman as a character reaches, I don't know what the numbers are, Greg, but I would have to imagine how many people are on this planet. Billions.
Yeah.
In America alone, we have hundreds of millions of people who are aware of Batman as a character. Whatever the hell Batman does in a comic book is not going to affect, you know, little Jimmy who asks his mommy and daddy for a lunchbox with Batman on the front. They're not going to think about what just happened in the stupid comic. They're not going to, consider that when they go to the toy store and he wants an action figure. They're not going to consider that when the new Batman animated series comes on and he wants to watch it. They're not going to consider that in a couple years when Batman is doing things in the movie theater and they want to go see it. Though, those are the areas where legitimate profits can be made from a corporate standpoint on the character. You know, 100,000 comic books, Greg, at $4 a pop represents what? Maybe a $300,000 profit for DC month to month?
Yeah, I don't know. Plus, you have to pay the writer. You have to pay the artist. You have to pay to publish it, which doesn't cost that much.
My point being, actual publishing sales of Batman comics, let's be generous and say they net $10 million a year for DC Comics. That is nothing. That is a line item in the grand scheme of corporate budgets for a company such as an AT&T or a Disney. It's irrelevant for the most part. It's irrelevant from a financial standpoint, and it's irrelevant from a larger perception standpoint. The character of Batman is ingrained in pop culture. You're not going to be able to do anything in the comic at this point that will take that away. Certain characters are larger than the comics in which they star now.
Are you making an argument, though, for a lack of quality control in comics?
How do you mean?
If your argument is nothing can be done to hurt these characters, then why even care about the quality of the comics? Why not just instead of putting Tom King on Batman, why not just put, I don't know, your worst writer on Batman and not have to pay him as much?
That's an interesting point. You have kind of, not necessarily to that degree, but you've advocated for that approach where you think, or you have said in the past anyway, that you think A-list creators, and I think whether you like Tom King or not, over the last few years, he's become an A-list creator.
He's an A-list creator.
Are better served on B-list characters.
Yes, that's my feeling on it, because we've had that. My theory on that is that there is a segment of comic fans that will follow Tom King to whatever he writes, or that will follow Jeff Johns to whatever he writes, or follow Scott Snyder to what. Every time I say Scott Snyder, I have to catch myself from saying Scott Steiner. But follow Scott Snyder to whatever book that he writes. So putting them on a Plastic Man or a Green Arrow or someone might have more net value than sticking them on Batman. Just the theory that I have. I don't know if it would play out that way in real life, but that's just something that I feel at this point because of the relative exposure of Batman. When's the last time that Batman wasn't DC's top-selling character was, I guess, back in 2009 when Green Lantern was temporarily that. So, you know, or 10 or whatever it was. So, yeah, it is a book that can survive a lot. But I think quality control still needs to be a thing because I think goodwill matters. I do think sales matter in comics. I do think they're overestimated, to your point. But I don't know. I don't have the answers to this. I don't, you know, maybe there's some lightning in a bottle that I'll pick up an issue and it'll just catch me and I'll be like, man, this is so great. I got to read this. For the record, one of the last times that I felt that compelled about a new story that I wasn't already invested in might have been that first issue of Secret Empire that I read a couple years ago, and I never followed through with it. And then I read through legal means, I read the last issue of that comic or that series, and I was like, well, I'm glad I didn't invest in that. But that being said, it's just so hard at this point to hook me. But I'm like you. I'm not making apologies for not pulling comics anymore. We're still talking about comic books on this show. They're just comic books from years ago.
Yep.
Still comic books.
Absolutely. So I don't know. I mean, all that being said, you know, I don't really know. We'll see. We'll see what happens. And at least I think Rich Johnston over at Bleeding Cool has already coined our new hashtag, Release the King Cut. So we can be prepared to see that for years to come.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. The Snyder Cut people are like, man, they're committed to their gimmick, man.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he has said that the script, this is off topic, but I read an interview with Zack Snyder this week where he said that the original script that they wrote never got shot.
Right.
So there is no true Snyder Cut. Like there are versions of scenes that he shot that didn't make it film, but it's still not his original vision. So like, let it go, people. He's not going to make the movie as he originally wrote it. It's not going to happen. Anyway, well, we got some tragic news in the world of comics to transition here from our silly debates. Tragic news as a comic book veteran has passed away as a result of a battle with cancer. Colorist Justin Ponsor died this past weekend. He had been battling cancer for some time. And he primarily worked with Marvel, it says here, and had quite a few books on his name. He was considered a huge talent in the industry. Jim Lee talked about bringing him into Wildstorm and what a great talent he was and what a nice guy he was. So always sucks to lose someone from the industry, especially at the age of 42, way too young.
Absolutely. Not familiar with a lot of his work, but condolences to his friends, family, and of course fans of his work as well.
100%. Well, let's move on to the other topic that – and I think we made the right decision, but the other topic that we considered putting first here on the show, certainly the topic.
It has been a controversial week in the old Batcave.
Absolutely. So Batman, the biggest superhero in the world, most well-known superhero in the world, arguably, will next be played on the big screen by?
Allegedly.
Allegedly, who's a brand new actor that I've heard good reviews about. Allegedly has performed on Broadway a few times. No, he will be the heavy rumors and innuendo even indicate that Twilight actor Robert Pattinson will be the next Batman in Matt Reeves' upcoming movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, naturally, reactions to this, as they are every time Batman is cast, have been strong.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, have been particularly strong due to Robert Pattinson's presence in the film series Twilight.
Yes.
So let's talk about a couple of things here, Nick.
Yes.
Let's talk about our initial reactions to this.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about our, reactions to this, and let's talk about our overall thoughts on this now that we've had time to really, really process these events.
Okay. On first reaction, I hate it.
Yes.
I don't, and it's not just the Twilight thing. It is He does not look to me like a believable Bruce Wayne.
Agreed.
He's a little bit too pale. He's a little bit too thin. I just don't see Bruce Wayne when I look at him. That being said, I have never watched any of his non-Twilight movies, and of his Twilight movies, I've only seen like 30 or 40 minutes of one of them that I caught on TV in the same room as while I wasn't paying attention, and my wife was watching it.
Was it Twilight? Was it Twilight Saga New Moon?
Dude.
Was it the Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 1 or the Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 2?
I don't know the answer to that question because I wasn't paying attention to the film. Or
was it his 2011 film Water for Elephants?
It was not that because Kristen Stewart was in this. I know that. Mm. And in that movie, he was not good. But what I saw in that movie, no one was good. So I don't know if that's his fault. If that's somebody else's fault, I don't know. The fact remains, I hated it on first listen. So, what about you?
I did too. Yes. I did too. I instantly thought and it's really unfair for me to say though, because I'm looking through his filmography. I don't think I've ever seen him in anything. Right. I'm looking at it right now. I've not seen any of the Twilight movies. I am aware of them,
right?
But I have not seen them. I have not seen either of the Harry Potters that he was in, I don't think.
And then we had our good friend Joe Johnson on Twitter out there talking about people who are complaining need to go watch his indie work. Brother, if I'm not going to pick up a comic book and read it right now, I sure as shit ain't about to watch no indie independent movie. Like, not for me, typically, in all the ways, is independent cinema. So, no, I'm not going to do that.
I might go watch The Childhood of a Leader, or perhaps Eternal Sunshine of the Elephant's Water.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I have, like our friend Joe, I have seen many good reactions to his work in other films.
Mm-hmm.
So then, for I don't know about you, Nick, but for me, my next standpoint was to pause and think back to all the times that I've reacted that way to casting announcements. And I was like, well, we've talked about it on the show, Nick. I know you weren't negative on it like I was. I was way down on Heath Ledger when he got cast.
I was more like – granted, a large portion of that at the time was after seeing even Batman Begins, I had 100% faith in Chris Nolan for everything at that point. Like, he had given me a take on Batman that I never anticipated I would ever see on the big screen. And like, after that, I was in the bag for pretty much anything he wanted to do. So I was for the Heath Ledger casting at the time.
And I've had that reaction to other casting announcements over the years as well initially. And I was thinking, well, let me be fair about this. And then I realized that Christopher Nolan had cast Robert Pattinson in his next film, Tenet. And I thought to myself, if he's good enough for Christopher Nolan, he's probably good enough for me. What was your next step in the process, Nick?
I went instantly to the Nolan thing. That's where I was first. I was like, because, you know, you and I both follow the guy's career pretty religiously at this point. I knew that Pattinson was in it. And so I was like, hey, you know, if Nolan's casting him, there has to be something there. And then, of course, you start to read all the people on Twitter who are getting, you know, somewhat sanctimonious, self-righteous about it. Oh, all you people complain when Heath Ledger got cast. You complain when Michael Keaton got cast. You complain every time, and every time it works out. First of all, you're picking out the exceptions to the rule. I think we all bitched when Chris Klein got cast on The Flash, and we see how that turned out.
Mm-hmm.
Casting decisions that are criticized turn out badly just as often as they turn out for the best. So,
yes.
And just because Heath Ledger and Michael Keaton work out doesn't mean that I'm no longer allowed to have a negative opinion. You know, like you can have an opinion regardless of what the prior set of circumstances is. So those people who wanted to get all preachy about it can fuck directly off as far as I'm concerned. But in the end, I come at it from a standpoint of, I just don't know. Like, and the thing that will benefit Robert Pattinson is I'm going to go watch that Chris Nolan movie next year that he's in. I'm probably going to fucking love it, and then I'm going to be all for it. This will be a completely different discussion a year from now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more concerned about, like, the script and the story and the tone of the movie at this point than I am who's in it. Because I haven't – I watched that first Apes movie and thought it was okay and haven't seen any of them since. I don't even think he did that first one. I don't even know. So that's my point. Casting, the least of our concerns at this point, I think.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. I thought about it and I was like, you know what? He's probably a good actor. He probably is a good actor. I haven't seen him in anything. I have no reason to doubt the people that have indicated that he's given good performances. And if the material's written well and directed well, I'm sure he'll do a fine job. So I kind of come at it from the standpoint of it'll probably work out. So we'll see when it we got a long way to wait on it. So it's not like it's around the corner. So we'll see when the final product is out. And one does wonder if they make a decision in that movie that ruffles Bat fans' feathers, if they will then decide to walk that decision back.
You know, Greg, this is good because in the world of Greg Phillips, the comics gods giveth and the comics gods taketh away.
They have, in this case, they giveth me the gift of Tom King's run coming to an end.
Yes.
And again, whatever. And they take
just say it. You're happy about it. Just say it.
I'm not happy about the fact that they cut somebody's run short. I am happy with the fact that it's finally over. But that's, again, it really doesn't matter. I mean, I'm not going to buy Batman anyway at this point unless they put Joe Diffie on as the writer. Wouldn't that be great? Anyway.
The Bat pickup truck.
The Bat Cave has an 8-foot bed that never has to be made.
Oh.
Anyway.
Cargo light gives off a romantic glow.
Romantic glow. Prop me up beside the Bat computer if I die. Anyway. But the comics gods also have taken away from me by Kevin Feige's confirmation that the, quote, real Mandarin is coming to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That's right. Kevin Feige participated in an Ask Me Anything on Reddit recently, and he did answer one question from a Reddit user, Gentleman Gear Grinder, quote, Are there any plans to incorporate the Ten Rings from the first Iron Man or the real Mandarin teased in All Hail the King in the future? All Hail the King, for those who don't know, was the short film that accompanied one of the MCU DVDs, which followed the aftermath of Iron Man 3.
I think it was Thor the Dark World, but I'm not positive about that.
Feige responded with a simple and straightforward yes. So, much to my chagrin, the freaking Mandarin, the real Mandarin, is coming to the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Go ahead.
What do you want me to say, Nick?
No, I want you to react. I don't want you to just read the story. React. So often during this segment, what happens is you read the story and I react, and then you don't really say anything. This is one of those instances where you talk about it. You talk about how you feel.
Well, how I feel, Nick, is
it was Thor the Dark World, by the way.
I loved Iron Man 3. Yes. We've had that debate and discussion. I still do love Iron Man 3.
Yes.
And I loved the Mandarin twist in Iron Man 3.
Yes.
And I thought it was a bold decision and a fun decision and ignored a terrible racist character that didn't need to be involved in the MCU to make it a compelling movie or series. Now, I understand many people didn't like that twist. However, you yourself, as one of the most ardently anti-Iron Man 3 people that I know, have even made the statement that if you make a creative decision,
yes,
you need to stick to your guns.
You should.
They did not.
They did not. They have shown very little interest in much of anything that has happened in Iron Man 3.
Acknowledging, really, that it happened.
Yes.
And so which begs a lot of questions about that movie in particular. But nonetheless, they walked that back with the All Hail the King short. It felt like, hey, we were just kidding about that whole fake Mandarin thing. But it doesn't All Hail the King, and now this follow-up, kind of fundamentally breaks the narrative of Iron Man 3, the revelation that I am the Mandarin. And God. I don't know why he delivered that as Ed Hedden, but
that would have been a better. That probably would have been a better performance than an actor who I typically enjoy, Guy Pearce, gave in that movie.
Aldrich Killian.
Oh.
Nonetheless, it kind of fundamentally breaks that story to me, and I don't like walking back that decision. I think that's a rare misfire for the MCU. That being said, we talked about this on a recording that we made that hasn't made air yet. At this point, the MCU could do anything, and it will probably be good. You could tell the MCU, all right, I'm giving you a script right now, Kevin Feige, and in this script, it is a two-hour movie consisting of nothing but Thor taking a shit.
They would probably
squeeze that shit into a diamond.
That's right.
And it would make $1 billion at the box office. So they're going to pull this off. It's going to be great. I'm certain of it.
Right.
And yet, I still don't like it. and it angers me because it's a movie that I enjoyed is being doo-dooed on.
I think part of the reason you don't like it is because you've spent so many years at this point defending it, you know, and so
yes.
Now it almost feels like Marvel, like Kevin Feige and Marvel themselves are siding against you, I think.
Yes, they're saying this was a mistake. We should not have done this. And I also kind of hate it because it's I hate it for a couple of reasons. That I hate it for walking back that decision, and I hate the kind of precedent that it sets that going away from the comic books is a bad thing. And I know some people would think that it is. I like when the MCU diverges.
So
I really do.
I don't necessarily think that it's just the fact that they went away from it. Like, so you were talking about there's no two ways of getting around it. The Mandarin absolutely is rooted in a very racist, stereotypical portrayal. That's you go back and read those early Mandarin comics, and they're cringeworthy and offensive. Similarly, you go read early Black Panther comics, and the same thing could be said for M'Baku the Man-Ape. Mm-hmm. And yet, in Black Panther, they were able to reinvent that character without making him a joke. And I think
they changed him in just as fundamental of ways.
They changed him fundamentally.
They did it in a different way.
Yes,
they made him a more heroic character.
Yes,
they changed. There's no comparison between the Man Ape of 1960s Marvel and what we got on the screen last year.
That I think what I'm saying is there are ways to update a character. There are ways to escape the racist trappings without making it a joke. And I think that's
my argument to that would be, what's wrong with making the Mandarin a joke?
Because
why is that fundamentally the wrong thing to do?
Because Iron Man is a character who, in the comics, I think even you would agree, lacks dynamic villains, right?
Certainly.
Whether you like it or you don't, the Mandarin, for the vast majority of Iron Man's publishing history, would be seen as his greatest adversary. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're developing an Iron Man franchise that is already lacking in villains, why would you take arguably his greatest adversary and turn him into a joke?
Greatest is a different
his most frequently recurring adversary.
Yes.
Who the kayfabe character of Tony Stark would tell you is his greatest foe.
The question I would have then is, you already have in the movie, you led with a villain in Ironmonger who was very serious. Mm-hmm. You followed with Ivan Vanko, who was a serious character, and Justin Hammer, who was a serious character from the comics, as far as I know, mm-hmm. that was turned into a comedy character. Mm-hmm. Aldrich Killian is a very serious villain.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's God. Yeah, that's true.
And in that movie, you use this version of the Mandarin for what I thought was a pretty clever. And I think there's a difference in the Mandarin and the Joker. Like, you're not dealing with an iconic character that people are just invested in and have expectations of. You can do whatever you want with him, in my opinion. And with Iron Man in particular, once you use the Mandarin, what do you do then? You have nothing. It's not like he's got all these other great villains, but you've got MODOK, you've got AIM, you've got all kinds of possibilities to mine. I guess they did use AIM in Iron Man 3, right?
Yeah, they mentioned it. Yeah, I mean,
but you know, you've got other characters you can mine. I don't think that it's bad to sacrifice one character. I would, by the way, with Batman, once you get to the sort of, I would have no problem with a comedic Penguin in a Batman movie. I wouldn't have a problem with that at all. He's kind of a goofy character to begin with, and well, I mean, he has to be goofy.
And see that brings up two things on that in that example. One, you generally prefer a more comedic approach than I do. I think we would agree on that. And two,
yes, sir.
You hate Oswald Cobblepot as a character.
That's true as well.
So, like, that example there, it's speaking, like, you kind of want to see the Penguin made into a joke of a character.
I think you kind of
wanted to see the Mandarin turned into a joke of a character.
Sure.
Whether you knew it at the time or not.
I didn't know it at the time. Right. Right. At the time, that's the other thing. I was fully expecting real Mandarin. I was fully expecting Ben Kingsley is the Mandarin. Mm-hmm. And I loved the fact that they didn't go that route, that they turned my expectations on their head. And with Cobblepot, I have seen other versions of him that worked for me. Like, for instance, the version on the Telltale game? Mm-hmm. I liked that twist on Oswald Cobblepot. It was totally different from what I was used to.
He's good in the Arkham series, too.
And the Arkham series, yeah. So kind of Cockney accent, right? Mm-hmm. So there's ways to do different things that aren't comedic, but I think I'd be fine with him being comedic. And I think you could have a comedic, God forbid, you could have a comedic Joker, honestly. At this point, you're not going to out-serious Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
So it's not the end of the world when you do that. And regardless, I don't like the idea that, a portion of the fan base reacted negatively to this, so let's undo it. Because if they didn't like the decision from the get-go, they just wouldn't have put it in the movie. They had complete ability, as they've shown countless times, to step in and tell Shane Black, hey, this is a dumb idea, don't do it.
Hey, hey, at no point I'm, did they I'm do with that. You, Greg. I don't like when we let a portion of the audience dictate story either.
What is that a reference to?
Oh, nothing. We only spent an hour on it at the beginning of the show.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Did Iron Man 3 make a lot of money or not?
Oh, it definitely did. No doubt. And my actual thing with the Iron Man 3 thing is, we've talked about this before, how retcons in comics or reboots in comics or whatever, I don't think they should take away from you loving a story.
No, and they don't. And they don't.
And so I would hope that, like, whatever happens with the real Mandarin going forward, you know,
it's not going to affect my enjoyment of Iron Man 3.
So,
these movies woven together in a tapestry. And I say that, but it's in a weird way that Coulson thing on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has somewhat impacted my enjoyment.
And that's so weird to me because, like, they don't even pretend to acknowledge that that's the thing anymore.
Right. It's just hard for me to get it out of my head, you know, when I see that scene, for me to invest in it fully. It's a great scene.
I don't even think about, like, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. ever. When I think about the MCU, it is
or just in general, probably.
No, I don't. It's a non-factor to me. So I'm, you know, as someone who's been, I think I've been somewhat critical of the Mandarin twist. I don't think I've been as critical as some people out there. I admit at the time to thinking it was clever, but being a little disappointed that they didn't give a serious attempt at revamping this character and redefining the character in a way that was more sustainable and more, you know, could possibly influence the comics in the way that we all hope Robert Downey Jr. had, like, you know, kind of set the stage and provide the template for a new generation of Mandarin stories, redefine that character for a new generation, essentially what I'm saying. And I think even you would agree, as someone who likes the twist, there's not really anywhere else, like, you can't really take Trevor Slattery. You know, there's nowhere else to go.
There's nowhere to go with it. There's nothing else to do with that version of the Mandarin once you reveal. Absolutely, that's the end of the run for that character.
Right.
Whereas you could still tell more stories with, you know, I guess with, did Vanko die at the end of Iron Man 2? I don't even remember.
Yeah, he got vaporized by
the
beam thing. But no, like, and like you said earlier, agree or disagree with it, there, I have no doubt at this point they're going to come up with a take.
Oh, it's
going to be awesome.
Gonna matter. When the time comes and they bring in the Mandarin to probably be the Shang-Chi villain, I would imagine, it'll be great. It'll be fantastic. I have no doubt about that. I'm really excited about that.
I didn't even consider it being the Shang-Chi villain. That probably will be awesome.
Yep. So another thing that will probably be awesome, Nick, the Arrowverse is gearing up for the big crossover next season, which I think all of us know will be Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Oh, yes.
It's the big one, baby. And we got confirmation of something we all suspected. Entertainment Weekly has reported that 5 shows will be involved in the Crisis next year. Arrow, The Flash, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, and Batwoman will all be involved in the crossover, airing over 5 hours, beginning, interestingly enough, Nick, beginning at the end of the midseason and picking up after the season returns in January. So there's going to be a big cliffhanger.
But read that one more time. Sorry.
So
the last part about it's
beginning at the end of the midseason in December, and then they're going to take their break, and then it will come back and finish in January.
Ooh, they are going. God, that sucks. You already know how that's going to end. What that cliffhanger is going to be, as we'll discuss in the reading and watching.
Yeah, the only surprise that I have here on this is that Black Lightning, as of now, is not involved.
I saw that as well, and I'm a little surprised. The only thing I can think of is that the showrunners for Black Lightning are not directly affiliated with the Berlanti Guggenheim people, and that they kind of typically operate a little bit more independently. So maybe they didn't want to be involved. But I would have thought all hands on deck, you know, for something like
this. And I think pure speculation here, folks. We, again, don't have any insider knowledge, but I think both of us are expecting a smashing together of worlds as a result of this this crisis.
Yes.
Where we're going to get Supergirl certainly brought into the main fold, and I was thinking Black Lightning as well. And I still think that's a possibility, even if they're not officially involved in the crossover. But how great is this going to be, man? I'm so excited about this.
Oh, it's going to be amazing. Can't wait.
Speaking of can't wait, Batwoman trailer officially dropped.
Go ahead. I want to talk about this, actually.
Starring Ruby Rose as Kate Kane, and it appears to be the show that is going to sort of take Arrow's place as the quote-unquote dark and gritty show on the CW. And this trailer, I thought, was really, really good.
That was awesome.
What about you?
Loved it. Have questions, though. So, in the trailer, we see a version of Gotham that is without Batman, and yet Batwoman has not come to exist. We see Ruby Rose kind of, as Kate Kane, kind of coming to terms with the fact that Gotham needs something. She isn't sure what. We see her discovering the Batcave. We see her making her initial plans to become Batwoman.
Right.
And yet, our first introduction to her in last year's crossover, she was Batwoman. She was fully formed. We got Batwoman in the show.
Which makes it seem like this is going to be like a prequel show or something.
Right.
Not a prequel show, but an origin show.
Right. But how is that going to work when it comes time for the show to cross over with?
Maybe the first episode is the origin of Batwoman.
And then
after that, there's a time jump.
Time jump?
Yeah.
You're going to have to, because they're not even beginning Batwoman at midseason. They're starting it at the beginning of the season. They're putting it in Supergirl back to back in a block together. So maybe the first mini arc will be that, you know, 3 or 4 episodes, and then you'll get the time jump or something. Or I don't know. It's all.
Or maybe this is an alternate version of Batwoman that is going to be smushed together into the Crisis or something. I don't know. But yeah. I'm assuming that it's going to be the time jump thing that we were talking about earlier. Maybe it's even produced in a way similar to Arrow Season 1 with the flashbacks and all that.
There you go. That's actually a good idea. And we saw flashbacks in the trailer to her military past and stuff. So, no, but I love the trailer. It looks awesome. you know, when I was reading the Batwoman book a couple of years ago, I kept telling you I think there's big time potential in this character, mm-hmm. and I'm very excited about this show.
Me too.
It, as much as we love Arrow, I think you and I would both agree this show has kind of fundamentally changed from what it was in those early years that made us love it so right. much.
And particularly then, season one.
And how yep. much did, like, when you were watching this trailer, did it look like early Arrow?
It looks like season one of Arrow, yeah.
And I'm absolutely. Pumped for that, because that means we'll get a season two, you know, like almost we'll get to experience that all over again and get right. to get to find that, maybe find that sweet spot that and Arrow has kind of lost, I think, a little bit of.
And I think there's room for crossover for some of those Arrow villains and characters too on Batwoman. Yes. Whether you think about Talia popping up again and feuding, so to speak, with Batwoman. Whether you think about someone like Bronze Tiger possibly mm-hmm. showing up on there, you know, there's a lot of room for crossover there. So, big fan of that trailer. Hopefully, it delivers.
Do you think they'll have Maggie Sawyer pop back up on that show?
Ooh, I hadn't actually thought about that. That's not a bad idea. Not a bad idea at all. Particularly, they have to smash Supergirl into the Arrowverse
right
first.
Which I think that makes we all kind of assuming is yeah. going to happen.
But I think that long term, that would make a lot of sense, and would even create a chance to maybe move to maybe have some interaction with Kara's sister. What's her damn Alex. Name? Alex with Kate as well. So there's a lot of potential there
and
for sure.
And I'm also enjoying very much, as you know, I'm higher on the relationship than you are. I'm very much enjoying the Sarah and Ava thing on Legends, but. You know, I think there are some interesting story directions to be explored with Sarah on Batwoman, in mm-hmm. Batwoman, around Batwoman.
Through Batwoman. I by the way, I like the Sarah and Ava relationship. I just didn't like the on and off again thing.
Right.
So that's not all from the CW-verse, though, Nick.
It's not.
In fact, we got word that a Deathstroke animated series is coming
right up
to
your alley.
CW Seed. Boy, oh
what
boy.
What a terrible... By the way, is there a worse name for a streaming service than
CW Seed? Although, it does remind me of the plight of legend wrestler Abdullah the Butcher, because he spilled him seed.
He spilled Hep C, Greg.
Oh, my mistake.
All he wanted was to bleed. And they said he spilled Hep C. Can't tour Japan.
Cause he's old.
In the knees. Never made it, never will.
Never will. Now
son, you will burn in hell. Man. Do you think there's anybody listening who got that besides Todd?
Doubtful.
Doubtful.
Doubtful. Extremely doubtful.
And do we care? No.
Abdullah, he beat Killer Khan, Bruiser, Brody Stan Hans. Anyway, a Deathstroke animated series is coming to this digital platform, which you can get as an app. It's pretty cool. It has been confirmed by CW President Mark Pedowitz, and it will reportedly be similar in format to the previous CW Seed animated shows, Vixen and The Ray.
What's it cool about those, I haven't actually watched them, but from what I understand, they're not entire episodes. They're like 5-minute shorts that then combine together into almost like an animated movie. Like you can watch
right.
the entire thing in a reasonable sitting. So mm-hmm. essentially, if you're getting a Deathstroke animated movie out of the deal, that's got to be pretty exciting for you, right?
That is very exciting. Right now, it's unclear if Manu Bennett will be reprising his role as Deathstroke, but it appears likely,
yes.
given that that was the case with Vixen and the Ray. And if
Vixen
that's the case,
and Ray and Constantine, all, yes.
Yep. And if that's the case, you would think that this – I would think, Nick, I'm just speculating, that this would follow the story of Slade after he last left Arrow when he goes around the world searching for his son. Who we know will become Jericho. So I'm all in on that, man. I love Manu Bennett's Deathstroke. I think he's great. And As you know, I was a big fan of the Deathstroke comic series out of Rebirth. So I'm super excited about this, actually. I think this is going to be really cool. I have watched previous anime series because I wasn't super invested in Vixen or the Ray, but I'm invested in Deathstroke, so I'll probably watch this.
Awesome.
And furthermore, we have more news, believe it or not, folks. That's right, the Disney Plus Marvel streaming series that are coming out. In particular, we want to talk right now about Falcon and Winter Soldier. This, I believe, Nick, maybe I'm wrong on this, this is the first one that they're going to do?
They haven't really confirmed their release plans, but most people believe that it will be very early, that it and Loki will probably be the two that are
right, Loki,
nearest the front of the live-action shows. What If is probably going to be ready to go pretty early in the run.
What if?
No word yet on the documentary offerings or WandaVision when that's coming. So, but yeah, fairly early in the existence of the streaming service, most people are assuming. What's crazy about that is that's like in 4 months. You know, like it's not that far away.
Well, they've said that Falcon and Winter Soldier will debut in August 2020.
Okay, so never mind.
It says in this article.
So there you go.
But Emily Van Camp, who played Sharon Carter in The Winter Soldier, that's Captain America, The Winter Soldier, as well as Civil War, and Daniel Brühl, who played Helmut Zemo in Captain America Civil War, a character that both Nick and I have been very, very high on. They are in talks to reprise their roles for Disney Plus's The Falcon and Winter Soldier. If true, this would be the first time that we've seen each of them since Civil War. And in particular, the character of Zemo is just appetizing here, is he not?
Yes. We have been advocating for his return pretty much since Civil War, and I'm glad to see they finally have plans of doing so. My only hope now is don't kill him off at the end of this. Keep him around, because I definitely want to see him and some Masters of Evil action on the big screen.
Yep. Perhaps in the guise of the Thunderbolts. Mm. That would be quite interesting. And another thing, Nick, that isn't nearly as interesting is the sport of golf.
Here we go. You just are crapping on all the things that are great. Crapping on Tom King, crapping on the Mandarin, crapping on everything. And now here you are to crap on one of the finest sports, a gentleman's game here in this great country. But go ahead.
Well, the Avengers, Marvel's group of Earth's mightiest heroes, are about to hit the links, Nick, because the Avengers are going to Marvel is partnering with the United States Golf Association to create exclusive golf education products to engage junior golfers on the essential elements
Absolutely.
To learning the game.
This is wonderful.
On the cover of this issue, you have the likes of Iron Man, which makes sense, Hawkeye, Black Panther,
now what are
Black
you trying,
Widow.
What are you trying to say about Iron Man?
Miss Marvel and the Incredible Hulk playing golf. I'm saying that golf is historically a sport enjoyed predominantly by wealthy individuals.
Oh.
And
am I wealthy,
Tony Stark
Greg?
Is a wealthy man.
I'm not wealthy.
No, you're not independently wealthy. But what I'm saying is that traditionally that has been the that's been the audience there, right?
Well, all I can hope for in these what I'm sure are going to be outstanding tie-in comics, as all independently licensed tie-in comics typically are, is that we will have a scene where the Avengers use a whiteboard to attempt to explain the various scoring systems in the great game of golf to enthralled onlookers. And maybe you will finally learn a thing or two about one of our finest, the finest offerings the sports world has in its purview. So hopefully you will read these and gain a newfound appreciation for the great sport of golf.
Now, Nick, I was hoping you would go there with the whiteboard and the attempts to explain the rules of golf and the gentlemanly aspects of it. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's a chance to potentially involve the X-Men in this, and then maybe to compare the Summers family tree mm-hmm. with the rules of golf?
Possibly. There's that possibility. The rules of golf are quite simple, but actually quite complex, you see. So, possibly.
I mean, yeah, we it just remains to be seen. Well, mercifully, folks, that's the end of the rundown. We have thoroughly beaten these topics into the ground. We have explored all there is to explore right now. So let's move on. Mm-hmm. So Nick, what should we do next? We go on to the long book. Should we take a break? Should we go ahead and do reading and watching?
Yeah, we're just gonna do the whole back half. We're flipping the show on its head this week.
All right, let's do it. So let's move on to the segment where we talk about what we've been reading and watching. The segment known the world over as Reading and Watching.
We ain't read nothing.
Nope, no reading. So let's get to the watching, shall we?
Yeah, let's do that.
We've been watching stuff. And particularly our stories we've been watching as they are reaching the end of the road for yet another season. For some of them, the penultimate season. For some of them, just another cog in the ongoing wheel. So let us get started, Nick. I know you have been keeping up with Supergirl. So what's been going on? How are you feeling about that?
I'm feeling pretty good. I've largely enjoyed this season. John Cryer has not been nearly the train wreck that I believed he was going to be, even if I still have minor quibbles with the performance from time to time. But the story is intriguing. It's going in an interesting direction, and we've got one more episode left to cover. I'm going to try not to comment on it too much until you've had a chance to catch up, but at this point, and granted, I felt this way, I think Supergirl has a history of lackluster season finales. I think there's a strong argument to be made. This might be the best season, top to bottom, of Supergirl to date. It's either this or the Mon-El season. It's one or the other.
I just almost knocked over one of my TVs. Good Lord. And, yes, so moving on, the last week's episode of Legends of Tomorrow, Nick, what did the folks experience on that one?
Yeah, so we're going to do this a little bit out of order and tackle Legends first before we get through the season finales. But this episode saw the unveiling of kind of what Neron's ultimate plan is. We've got him in the body of Ray Palmer alerting the world to the existence of magical creatures and offering to protect them all in the guise of the Atom. All they have to do is download an app that will allow them to track magical creatures and inform him of their whereabouts. What they don't realize is in the terms of service for the app, they are forfeiting their eternal souls to Neron the Demon.
So who reads that, right?
Nobody reads that stuff. So it's a pretty brilliant piece of writing, once again, from the Legends creative team. But largely, that's what the episode focuses on. You've also gotten, in the meantime, the Legends having to deal with the fact that Gary is now bonded to the fairy godmother. And so they're all trying to kiss Gary's ass for the large majority of the episode. And then eventually, Tabitha, the fairy godmother, is able to talk Nora into taking her curse. I didn't follow all that, to be honest, but good episode nonetheless.
And also in hell, Constantine has gone to hell in search of the soul of Ray Palmer, but he's presented a deal by this triad of demons. All the hell stuff was great to me.
Yes.
Like I was fascinated by the triad of demons of like Satan and Lucifer and all these others. And they, they're probably the same, but nonetheless. And, how they offer Constantine as sort of Sophie's choice of which soul to save. He can save the soul of Ray Palmer, or he can save the soul of Astra. Now, for those that might remember the Constantine solo show on NBC, Astra was a little girl that John is haunted by because he failed to save her. He promised her he would protect her soul, and he lost her to the demons of hell. And so John makes the choice to save Astra rather than Ray, only to find that he's been deceived because Astra has grown up in hell and now likes it there mm-hmm. and has adjusted. And so she betrays John, turns him over to demons to torture him, and things just look bleak for our heroes on Legends.
Absolutely. Good episode, though.
Yes, it was a very good episode. I enjoyed virtually everything about it. Even a little bit, I enjoyed Gary just because he was being presented in a different manner. And then I didn't enjoy Gary. But, you know, you can only do what you can with Gary and Mona. But overall, it was a very good episode. The hell stuff was great. You talked about this a couple episodes ago. Seeing Brandon Routh get to play a bad guy finally is really cool. He seems to be delighting in his role as Neron. And him making out with the fairy godmother was suitably surprising. So, yeah, good stuff all around.
Absolutely.
Which leads us to the first of two season finales, wrapping up two up and down seasons on Arrow and The Flash. Let's start with Arrow. Now, the whole back half of this season has been dedicated to this Emiko storyline. Found out that Emiko, Oliver's sister, is actually the head of the, what is it, the Ninth Realm?
Ninth Circle.
Ninth Circle. And I'm getting Legends and Arrow confused, realms and circles, but the Ninth Circle. She is the head of this. She killed Dante. She's taken over full control of this organization. Well, she's already always had it. And she's made it clear she's not going to be redeemed. She's not going to back off of what she's done. Oliver now knows that Emiko is responsible for the death of their father indirectly. And, you know, he's come to terms now with the fact that he's not going to kill her. He's got to try to redeem her for his own sake. The ghost of Tommy talked him into that last week. So Oliver and the team track her down. They go to infiltrate the building. They do infiltrate the building. Oliver is able to, in some ways, get through to Emiko. Not completely, but a little bit. Emiko is betrayed by the Ninth Circle. Murdered. Tragic ending. Obviously, there's spoilers. We'll put that on the tag here. Tragic ending for Emiko. But all of this is wrapped up pretty quickly in the episode.
Yeah, like 15, 20 minutes.
And then we get to the real point of the episode, as we find out, which is the aftermath. Mm-hmm. I guess I should also talk about the parallel story going on in the future.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we've been following that the whole back half of the season as well. The future team, whatever we want to call them, future Team Arrow, track down this this evil plot to destroy. That they realize how to destroy Archer, and Mia goes on seemingly a suicide mission with her brother William to infiltrate this building, have a big showdown with the bad guys. She's awesome. She kicks tons of ass, and they end up taking down Archer. And some great fight scenes here. I should also mention, by the way, that Bronze Tiger shows back up in this episode to help out Team Arrow, Michael J. White, and kicks 45 different kinds of ass with his Wolverine cloth thing that he has, and blood flying everywhere. Probably the most graphic action scene we've seen on Arrow since the prison part of the season. So really good fight scenes here. Then we get to the real meat of the episode, which is what happens to all these characters after they've completed their missions. We get Roy kind of ominously saying goodbye to the team, saying, in the future, they're like, hey, you never did tell us how you ended up on the island. And he says, well, that's a story for another time, a long story, and goes off. So that's left unsettled. The rest of the team is going to go off and try to keep protecting Star City. Oliver and Felicity are going to go off into hiding because the Ninth Circle is still after them. So Diggle, Oliver, and Felicity get this amazing goodbye with each other, right, where they go to this cabin where we've seen Mia get born in a flashback sequence or flash-forward sequence. And the then we get this montage of domestic life for Oliver and Felicity, and it's one of my favorite sequences probably in the history of the show, as simple as it was. And everything seems like they're genuinely happy for once, unlike when they went away at the end of season three and they just couldn't adjust to domestic life. Now it feels like they've each reached a point where they're good with it, and they're raising Mia as a baby, and it's all wonderful. And then the monitor shows up, and then at approximately that exact moment, my heart split in two and was crushed upon the ground.
Even though you knew it was coming.
even though I knew it was coming.
Yep.
And it was a heartbreaking scene due in, largely to the acting from Stephen Amell and Emily Bett Richards, who she deserves a ton of credit for this episode because she oscillates between badassery early part of the episode. She's angry when the monitor shows up. That's her first reaction is anger, and then it's devastation. And then she accepts it, but she's still devastated, but determined. And amazing performance from her, great performance from Stephen Amell. And we find out the monitor has come to collect. We find out what that deal that he made with the monitor was, that when he saved the lives of Barry and Kara, that Oliver had to step forward into the monitor's next plan for whatever the next crisis was, and that he wasn't going to be surviving it. He wasn't going to be returning from it. This was a one-way trip. And he goes with the monitor on this one-way trip. But they gave us a little bit of hope at the end because future Felicity reaches a point. She's seen for the protection of William and Mia, and now she has promised Oliver she would see him again, and she goes off with the monitor to face whatever it is in front of them, kind of putting her, as our buddy Russell told me in a message, kind of putting her in the role of the Earth 2 Lois. Mm-hmm. From the original Crisis. So, Nick, the first part of this, I hate to say this, but the first part of this episode was largely unimportant, right? They just kind of got, it feels like they wrapped the whole Emiko storyline up.
And that's like been my complaint with the Emiko storyline from the beginning. It just never felt important. Like, compared to even all the other big city threatening events that have gone on at the end of seasons in Arrow.
Certainly. It didn't feel as personal as Prometheus. It didn't feel as dangerous as Diaz.
I mean, like, and even though I think the story was much better and the episode itself and the conclusion was much better than the Damian Dark season, the Damian Dark threat felt more legitimate than this Emiko threat. You know, like it...
Especially, I think they needed a few more episodes to focus just on her,
right,
and on fleshing her out and having her get an advantage on the team physically, because that was the one issue I had, is that they never had her in a really get an advantageous victory over Oliver hand to hand, and that would have been a way to establish, oh shit, she's a legit threat, because Oliver is clearly the Arrow versus top hand-to-hand fighters.
Because every time they faced off, he pretty much handled her. Like,
yeah, he easily could have taken her out, except that she was his sister and he was trying to get used to her. So I think there's a little bit of an element of, you know, again, I say that, and there was an incredible fight sequence with the team, with the one that had Bronze Tiger in it. But yeah, it felt so forgettable. So if this episode had been that, it would have felt like the Damian Dark finale, I think, in some ways. But then they hit us with that back half of the show.
Right.
And that's probably as good a stretch of foot as we've ever seen on Arrow. So it was great, man. I the emotional connection thing, you know, because, again, I can't give it a perfect rating or anything because of that early part of the episode and how much they rushed through everything. Mm-hmm. But it was all – even that was really good action. And then that – emotional farewell and everything was just phenomenal. I
told you this offline. I stand by it. I do wish we had not seen future Felicity going off to be with Oliver at the end of this episode. Like, I think you could have ended this episode with the monitor taking Oliver off, and then, like, you got the reveal that Felicity was going to be reunited with him as your big feel-good conclusion to Crisis next year. Like, to me, this takes away a little bit.
I would sort of agree with that, except I think the idea of the conclusion to Crisis is seeing what that reunion resembles. Is it both of them alive? Is it both of them dead? What is it going to be? So I still think there's intrigue there. So I'm good with it, but I get what you're saying. But I love this episode. I thought it was great as a result of all the emotions, the fight scenes, and all that stuff. Yeah. And I maintain that the future Arrow team would make for a hell of a spinoff, because that – I told Connor and Mia are money, man. Those two have great chemistry, excellent fight scenes. She is I don't know the actress's name, and I'm not going to look it up right now because I'm lazy, but she's a badass, man. She's mm-hmm. great.
Yes.
And yes, I know you're a fan as well. But let's move on to Tuesday night's finale of The Flash, which I have to say is a little bit similar to Arrow in terms of it's burdened a little bit with having to wrap. I enjoyed the Emiko story more than I enjoyed the Cicada story, but it has to wrap up the season-long Cicada and Cicada 2 story.
It has to wrap up a lackluster story so it can get to the better story.
Right. And as we've said from the beginning of this season, Nick, the more interesting story is Eobard Thawne.
Right.
More interesting character is Eobard Thawne by a wide stretch. And luckily, most of this episode is dedicated to Eobard Thawne.
Mm-hmm.
Cicada and Cicada 2 stink up the first maybe 15 minutes, right?
Right.
And then they're done away with. They're finished. We're done with them forever, hopefully. And then we move on to the effects of what happens when they have to destroy that dagger. And that moment that dagger is destroyed and Thawne is released, they had me. And it reminded me that this show has never, ever, ever had a villain that has even come close to Eobard Thawne, in my opinion. He is so far and away the best villain on this show. There's no even competition. Zoom was fine. Savitar had his moments. Thawne is just next level. And then everything after that point was balls to the wall awesome. Including the horrible, horrible realization that Thawne killed Barry's mother and now is responsible for the vanishing of Barry's daughter, Nora.
Yes.
From the timeline. And Thawne gets off what I thought was one of the biggest dickhead villain lines that I've ever heard in the Arrowverse, when he tells Barry, in many ways, she's shown me what it would be like to have a daughter. I mean, what a dick. and Grant Gustin, the guy that can't act in movies, of course, delivers it with so much panache. He's so believable. His anger. I thought he might break Thawne's neck right there. and Thawne is so good, at played by Tom Cavanaugh, who's wonderful, both as Sherlock and as Thawne. Nora gets wiped out. There's this big emotional finale, emotional goodbye for Barry and Iris with their daughter. Again, outstanding acting. Candace Patton was great here as well as Iris. But Grant Gustin has just – I feel like this season, for all of its ups and downs, has given Grant Gustin more opportunities to deliver than maybe any season to this point. I can think off the top of my head maybe three or four scenes this year that are among the best scenes he's ever filmed in terms of acting.
Yeah, he's knocked it out of the park this year. And the season, while it was up and down, I think ultimately came in for a very satisfying conclusion. The Nora stuff, her disappearance. I mean, like,
the monitor.
Even if it didn't necessarily affect me in a way that was like it should have for her as a character, it definitely affected me for Barry and Iris and for my own, like, perspective as a parent. Like, that was that was good stuff.
That was one point I did want to make on there, is that I felt for Barry and Iris, but and it's a weird thing to say because we were very high on her in the early part of the season. I was as well, but I really grew to dislike Nora by the end of the season. Mm-hmm. She became a character that I was annoyed by and just didn't want to see anymore. And that's not the fault of the actress, who did a great job. It's really just that they wrote her to make the same kinds of mistakes over and over and over again. I know impulsive kids do that, but it also was never made clear exactly how old she's supposed to be. And I got tired of it. I got tired of her constantly screwing up. I got tired of her whining all the time. And so it didn't affect me the way that it probably should have. That being said, the acting was great, and the effect that it had on Barry and Iris was frightening, and you can't shake off the appearance of the monitor. So we're going to see the crisis play out next year.
The monitor in Flash. What did he do?
Maybe he didn't appear. You're right. Maybe he did not appear.
I thought we got the time chamber.
That's right. It was the time change. Yeah, yes. I was – the monitor only appeared on Arrow and and that's it. But the
I already know he appeared on Legends of Greg.
So okay, all right, well, good. So, but the Flash gave us the another unintended effect of the timeline changes, which is that the crisis has now been moved up to 2019 as opposed to 2024. So, lots of ramifications to go. Do you think we're going to get the crisis from the jump next year, or is it going to be kind of like a slow build into it?
Well, I mean, at least on Arrow, we have to be getting to it pretty quickly because
I think, yeah,
Oliver is with the Monitor now. So, like, unless you're, God forbid, they do like an entire half season of just Team Arrow with no Oliver. They wouldn't do that, would they?
The only thing that I would watch is if it was future Team Arrow or if it was Diggle. If they did like Diggle for half the season, I could deal with that.
But they wouldn't do. Like, oh God!
No, they wouldn't do it. They would give us Black Canary and Wild Dog, and probably bring back Curtis.
Oh no, no. Let's just do Crisis over there then.
Good stuff on our shows this week. Also, I watched another episode of Young Justice on DC Universe. And a good episode, probably the first one that I haven't been super high on. They go to Santa Prisca. Wasn't nuts about this take on Bane, but it wasn't bad. It wasn't
the same take as Young Justice has always had, right?
Yes, yes. But just some of his reactions were not really Bane-like to me. But it was still fine, and they did some really cool stuff with a character that is underutilized across DC media, which is Metamorpho.
Interesting.
So that was cool to see. But yeah, good stuff there. I don't think I've watched anything else comic book related. I watched Endgame again last week, and that was amazing, as you would expect. Mm-hmm. So with that being said, let us wrap up this first half of the show and take a break. Mm-hmm. And when we come back from the break, we will have the Long Book Hunters somehow on New Avengers by Brian Michael Bendis. Stay with us. I know you will.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, back inside the studio, ready for our main event of the evening, Nick. But before we get to that, before we get to the main event here, let's pay a few bills, shall we?
Mm-hmm. Throw some respect to our fellow Place to Be Nation podcasts, and we'll start as we do each and every week over on the Pop Feed, where we have a little something for everyone. Stephen Kelly, look at me tongue-tied already. Stephen Kelly celebrate 1 year of Songs with Friends. Man, has it been that long already? An entire year of Songs with Friends, Greg. What are your favorite episodes of Songs with Friends?
I liked the one where they talked about NSYNC.
Mine too.
Personally,
Songs with Friends by live watching some classic NSYNC. We got a watching it, I guess, a concert, a video, I don't know. We got a heavy dose of hoops talk for you, courtesy of Cowboy and D'Amato on This Week in Sports, and Adam and Andrew on the NBA team.
Hey, let me tell you about the NBA real quick, Nick.
Yeah, tell us about it.
So apparently, I was a fool for writing off the Toronto Raptors because they had tied that damn series up. So,
well, I mean, they won two games at home. I'm still taking the Milwaukee Bucks in that one.
I will as well, but I there's a potential for me to end up with egg on my face after some things that I may have said at work regarding the Toronto Raptors. So.
Toronto Raptors. I'll tell you this, if it's the Toronto Raptors, you might as well not even watch the damn NBA Finals. I think the Bucks. No. I think the Bucks have a puncher's chance, a very poor puncher's chance. I think the Raptors have no chance.
The Bucks have like a bald bull chance, and yes. The Raptors have a glass Joe chance.
Yes. They have a Dominic Brazil chance.
Oh, he hit that man very hard.
Did you see his post-fight press conference?
No.
Oh, it was awesome. He said something to the effect of, I didn't come after Brazil. Brazil came after me, and it became personal. And I'm going to tell you right now, this ain't no gentleman's game. This is the only sport in the world where you can kill somebody and get paid for it. So why wouldn't I try to kill that man? And I said, good Lord. Good Lord. I'm not saying he's as good as Tyson, but not since Tyson have I felt genuinely terrified of a boxer the way I now am of Deontay Wilder.
Oh, Lord. One punch.
He destroyed him, and it was beautiful.
Anyway.
Andy Atherton and Miranda Berthold are back in at the movies for a discussion on Detective Pikachu. I know you're excited about that one, Greg.
It does look like a good movie. I'm a big fan.
I'll be honest. Like, the trailers look good.
The trailers are good.
I probably won't get a chance to go see it at this point.
It's funny.
I'm going to watch it on Netflix when it comes out.
Yeah.
You know, I was a Pokemon fan when I was a kid. I haven't really cared about it in, God, 20 years at this point. But, hey, at least I'll know some of the what's going on, probably.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular has returned, and Glenn and Scott are breaking down Star Trek Discovery Season 2.
Yes, I had CBS All Access, as you know, during football season, and I thought, while I'm paying for this, I might as well watch Star Trek Discovery, but I never did. I'm going to get it again probably this fall, and so when I do, I'll try to watch Season 1 and report back accordingly.
Yes. The Hard Traveling Fanboy – wait a minute. That's not what we're doing. The Hard Traveling Fanboys recently conducted a countdown. That's us. We had our top five Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes episodes. So check that out, and also be sure to stay tuned for our Hard Travelers for Hire finale that is coming up at the end of this month, and it will feature the unveiling of the composite rankings of all 22 MCU movies for Place to Be Nation.
And boys, let me tell you, and girls that are listening to this podcast, and any anthropomorphic animals that may be listening to this podcast, that is going to be a show you want to listen to.
Mm-hmm. All 7 hours of it.
Over at the PTBN Wrestling feed, meanwhile, JT and Chad are back in the wrestling war zone as they discuss what was going on in the WWF and WCW during the week of 1-8-96. I believe this is getting close. It's probably not that episode yet, but it's getting close to the Arn Anderson Hulk Hogan one-on-one match in which Arn gets a pinfall victory over Hulk, I believe. I could be misremembering that. In the fourth episode of Row 1, Seat 1, Ben Zaney chats with his buddies Tommy and Gator. Gator talks about his recent experience of promoting an independent show in the Washington, D.C. area. Not to be confused with Gator Steve Kern, who would become Skinner in the World Wrestling Federation. Scott and JT welcomed in Jambalaya Jake Williams to break down the 489 MSG house show featuring a big WrestleMania main event rematch, which can only be the Hulkster and the Macho Man, I would assume. And that's got to be a good show. And finally, Scott Criscolo, Nate Milton, and Steve Willey have previews of Money in the Bank, which has happened. Maybe this is an old version we're reading, but Money in the Bank and Double or Nothing on the newest edition of Main Event. Check that out for sure. And while you're at it, check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. This is a project counting down the greatest pay-per-view and television matches in the history of world wrestling entertainment. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list. So, all that out of the way, let's get on to the main event of the evening, what we purportedly gathered here today to talk about, which is a long book hunt to continue Avengers Month right here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. And to do so, we're going to read an Avengers comic book, and this has been something of a unique experience for us over the years, reading these Avengers stories. Neither of us are Avengers aficionados. We don't know much about trigonometry, geometry, or the Avengers from the comics. And our prior sojourns into the Avengers world have had some mixed results. I know you were higher on Ultimates 2 than I was, but I thought it was okay. And then we read the highly acclaimed Kurt Busiek and George Perez first volume of their run, and both of us were unimpressed.
Underwhelmed.
And haven't followed that run up since then. And I know you've been reading Avengers in Marvel Age, so you may be reading some great stuff on there.
Nope.
So, to this point, it's fair to say we've been underwhelmed by our Avengers experiences. So right now, yes, we're turning our attention to a book that Nick has read before that is very dear to him, a book that was in on the ground floor of your entry, I believe, into the mainstream Marvel Universe.
So I had to go back and read this. My entry into the mainstream Marvel Universe was essentially the road to Civil War. So New Avengers, if I remember correctly, had been running for about 18 issues at that point. But I went back pretty quickly, and I think I just sat in the bookstore one day and read the trades that were out and got caught up that way. So, and then I've read it a couple of times since, whether it be through Marvel Unlimited or other illicit means. So I've read New Avengers a couple of times. Kind of essential to a complete – if you're ever doing a complete reading of the Jessica Jones, Luke Cage story, you kind of have to have New Avengers in there, as we will – you know, as you will find if you continue to read this run, which we never do. But yeah, New Avengers is a book I absolutely love.
Yes, and so with that being said, it's a book that I had never read from the ground floor. I had read select issues of New Avengers when they were coming out contemporarily, not this early into the run, after I knew Nick, because Nick was the only person I knew who was pulling the book. And so I would read some of his issues when I was visiting him and stuff and in college. But it's a book called New Avengers, The New Avengers, really. And this was the first volume of this title, brand new title from Marvel Comics. It was a complete rebuilding of the Avengers brand, at the hands of writer Brian Michael Bendis and artist David Finch. Now, of course, Brian Michael Bendis is Nick's favorite Marvel Comics writer of all time, and he's had a long and prestigious career with Marvel. This was sort of in the, not the early stages of his career, but still in the first, I'd say, half of his career at Marvel.
He had officially become a star at this point. Like, between his Daredevil run and his Ultimate Spider-Man work, this felt like the first time where he kind of had his pick of assignments, and he chose Avengers. He chose to do Avengers Disassembled, and then chose to do this new Avengers run.
And he's partnered here with David Finch, who to this point, his biggest credit had been working with Brian Michael Bendis in a year-long story arc on Ultimate X-Men. Mm-hmm. So following out of that, they move on to the Avengers, and they do an event called Avengers Disassembled, which split up the traditional Avengers team by virtue of the Scarlet Witch. The events of that story would later lead to stuff such as House of M. And the Secret War miniseries, I believe. Mm-hmm. Not to be confused with Secret Wars, or is it vice versa? I can't remember.
No, Secret War is the one that takes place that kind of sets the stage for what happens with Civil War.
Right. So with that being said, the first volume is what we're reviewing here, the trade paperback volume, New Avengers Volume 1, Outbreak. And am I even right about that? Damn it. Breakout. My bad. Not Outbreak. Outbreak was a movie. But
the monkey,
nonetheless,
on the poster.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. This was a chance to rebuild the Avengers brand. It had kind of waned over recent memory since really since Busiek and Perez left. The brand had kind of treaded water a little bit, I think, from what I've read anyway online. And this was kind of restarting from scratch out of the shambles of what was left after Avengers disassembled. And from what I understand, Nick, you probably have more information about the backstage dealings on this than I do, but I think Bendis kind of got free rein on assembling a team that he really wanted for the Avengers.
Yeah, so I'm not really sure about the backstage finagling of this, but the major change here, and I think part of the reason we can't really talk about New Avengers without talking about the fact that it has something of a controversial standing in the larger Marvel fandom, particularly the fandom that is, you know, followed and become engrossed in Avengers continuity over the years. And part of the reason for that is the Avengers, while they have always purported to be Earth's mightiest heroes, for the vast majority of their publishing history, have never really taken what we call the Justice League approach. Because, Greg, you and I both know that over in DC Comics, the Justice League, for most of our lives, has focused on the tippy top, the cream,
the biggest of the
cream
of the, big, yeah.
of the crop, the top tier DC heroes together. That traditionally being Batman, Superman, The Flash, Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, and some combination of Aquaman or Martian Manhunter or Green Arrow or Hawkman and Hawkgirl. You know, those characters typically making up the lineup. Avengers pre-2008, because remember we have to talk about this in the context of a Marvel universe that was not yet being informed by the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Iron Man and Captain America were still B-list characters back then. They were still not really known or embraced by a large portion of the mainstream. If you were making a list of the most popular Marvel characters, you would start with Spider-Man and Wolverine. You might, after that, where would you go, Greg? Various other X-Men characters.
Hulk, maybe.
Venom, maybe. There, you know, various places you could go. This, however, is kind of a representation of attempting to do a hybrid between a more traditional Avengers lineup and what we call the Justice League approach of putting your most popular characters all on one team. So, something of a controversial book for Marvel fans, but and really a book that doesn't really read or feel like any Avengers story that I've ever read, and that may be the perfect explanation for why I love it so damn much, because I don't really like any other Avengers stories that I've read.
And do you feel that this you're more probably more tied and remember better the Ultimates than I do? I remember liking the first volume of the Ultimates a lot.
I like both volumes a great deal, as you know, but yes.
And do you think that that approach informed this new Avengers run at all, or were they just two totally separate things?
I think they were two totally separate things. I think what Millar was trying to do, or Miller was trying to do, was take that classic Avengers team and update them for the 21st century.
Right.
Whereas Bendis, and we talked about this offline, you know, he is trying to update the team, but not necessarily update the characters. You know, like, sure, he's putting his own spin on them, but like, as we'll discuss, Iron Man, for example, Iron Man reads like Iron Man has read for the vast majority of his publishing history. Captain America reads as you would expect. The Ultimates is trying to update these characters and make them feel more modern and contemporary and fresh. And Bendis, right, I don't think, was as concerned with making individual characters feel fresh as he was trying to make the concept of the Avengers feel new and different and fresh.
Right. Makes sense. And this story is built around the plot, really, of this story is a massive supervillain breakout from this facility called the Raft that is maintained by S.H.I.E.L.D. that is right off the coast of Rikers Island, and it is said to house the baddest of the bad. All the superpowered villains are housed here. It's basically an underwater Arkham in some ways. And they are it's a stockpile of villains for various Marvel characters. You're talking C and D list villains mainly, but some heavy hitters in there as well. Some guys like Tombstone that'll be familiar to readers. Anyway, in the very first issue, somebody makes a deal with Electro to break these villains out. And about 40 of these villains, 42 of these villains end up escaping and at the behest of Electro. And right now, at the beginning of this story, there are no Avengers. The Avengers do not exist. It's, they're all individual. And this, the, you know, what's the old Avengers phrase, cliche is, there came a day unlike any other. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the premise of this, is this, and they even frame it as this, Iron Man frames it as this, as does Captain America in the story, that this is a modern version of that day unlike any other, where happenstance and fate brings all these characters together. And it's an interesting conglomeration of characters. There's another one added in near the end that we'll talk about in a minute. But from issue two on, the reformed Avengers is Captain America, Iron Man, Spider-Woman, Jessica Drew, which is an interesting addition to say the least, mm-hmm. Luke Cage, mm-hmm. and Spider-Man. And I've been eager to talk to you about this, Nick, because you guys on Marvel Age are way past the point of the early Avengers issues. But I know it's kind of interesting that Spider-Man has been Marvel's most popular character for the most part, with some dips here and there for X-Men, since the 1960s, and yet has never been a member of the Avengers until now, until this story. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, we haven't really talked about that a ton because nobody's really got a definitive answer. The feeling has always been that Spider-Man from the jump really was a breakout success, an overwhelming success, to the point where you didn't really need him on the Avengers. He was a character who was so successful standing on his own merits that you didn't really need to put him on the Avengers to make him feel more important. And also, during the early days of Spider-Man continuity, Steve Ditko was very protective of that character. Very protective of how he should be used, how he should be portrayed, where he should be portrayed. And that led to Spider-Man not being used as much as you would later see in terms of crossover appearances and guest appearances. Now, why wasn't he put on the Avengers whenever Ditko left? I don't know. Really, by the time Ditko left, the Avengers had kind of changed its MO pretty drastically. They had gone to what our good friend Tim Capel calls Cap's Kooky Quartet, where Iron Man and Thor were kind of satellite members, and they had been replaced by Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, and alongside Hawkeye and the Black Widow, and you'd started to see that concept of the revolving Avengers lineup really introduced, and the Avengers, at least in the 60s and 70s, would go on to focus on increasingly more obscure characters rather than that Earth's Mightiest Heroes conceit. So I think part of it is Avengers just, for the vast majority of its history, was never meant to be that Justice League-style book. And if you put Spider-Man on there, it kind of becomes that.
One of the reasons I asked that, Nick, is There are some things here that don't work, and there are some things here that we'll get into and possibly disagree about the story itself and some of the uses of characters here. But the one thing that absolutely works the entire time is Spider-Man as an Avenger.
Yes.
I was talking about this with my boss earlier because I asked, he's a longtime Avengers fan, and I asked him his thoughts on this run. And as you might expect, his thoughts are mixed on it. He's got his issues with the run, but he said that's something that he thought worked from the get-go as well, was Spidey as an Avenger. It just – he is – let's be honest. He's the best character in this book.
Yes.
And Bendis writes him amazingly well. I have not read the Bendis Spider-Man – I'm not nearly the Bendis Spider-Man expert that you are. I haven't read that many Bendis Spider-Man issues compared to you, mm-hmm. but holy mackerel, the dude just gets Peter Parker in a way that a lot of writers don't. And yeah, I from pretty much from the first issue on, especially as it gets along, gets moving and moving, and you get the team dynamic. Spidey in a team dynamic is it just works. I don't even know how to explain it, but just his sense of humor, his ability to sort of take the piss out of any situation. It is vital to have that kind of a character on a team, in my opinion. Whether it, no matter who that character, whether it's Guy Gardner on a Justice League team or whatever, and he's just great here. And I don't know why I led with that, but I think that's kind of one of the biggest change to this Avengers approach that worked to me was adding Spider-Man to the mix, because he just adds such a, and especially when you compare him to what we talked about in some of our other Avengers stories that we've done, the kind of stodgy, you know, everybody kind of sounds the same kind of heroic take that can happen with Tony and Steve at times. It's important to have somebody to break up that dichotomy on the team. And Spidey does that. And Spidey can also serve as the butt of jokes, as he does a few times in this story. Really, really loved it, Nick.
Yeah, Spider-Man as an Avenger is great, but more specifically, Bendis getting to write any version of Peter Parker, whether it be Ultimate or otherwise, is
right.
It's still something that warms my heart, and I still hope to see it again one day in the pages of Marvel Comics.
Well, we've talked before about certain writers having pet characters, right? Characters that they like, they're going to feature on a team. Jeff Johns had Hal Jordan on the Justice League that he liked to feature. Well, Brian Michael Bendis has a pet character that – a few pet characters. Jessica Jones is one. Luke Cage is
– Kitty Pryde would be another.
Kitty Pryde is one. She is not in this book.
No, she is not.
But Luke Cage is added to the team. He's a character that Bendis is fond of. He had written him an Alias with Jessica Jones. Jessica Jones pops up, by the way, in this story very, very briefly. And he also has a pet character, apparently, in another Jessica, Jessica Drew, a.k.a. Spider-Woman, a character that, Nick, I didn't know anything about before I read this story.
Nor did I, honestly. I was first exposed to her through the pages of New Avengers and Civil War, and then later, of course, as we may or may not discuss in this review, Secret Invasion. And Secret Invasion was a story that Bendis had in mind to tell. I think he was given the direction to build a new Avengers team and was told that Civil War was coming down the road, and he kind of had the outline for Secret Invasion as kind of the next big Marvel event after Civil War. And so Jessica Drew is a character who has kind of played many sides throughout her history, much like the Black Widow. And I think he kind of, you know, I don't know this to be fact, but it would seem that he kind of arrived at this idea of using her here as almost a way to build long form to Secret Invasion.
Right. And I was going to say, much like the other new additions to the team, she works. I was instantly, not instantly, because in the first issue I was kind of like, who the hell is this? I don't care about her. But as the story rolled on, I became more and more interested in Jessica Drew as a character and wanted to know more about her. And particularly, they instituted that kind of not cliffhanger, that's the wrong word, but that sort of thread of she's playing both sides and she's working for somebody and we don't know who it is. And I thought that was very compelling. I thought the way that she talked to the other characters was compelling. She takes no shit from anybody. And, you know, the favoritism towards the character showed at one point later on, but we'll get to that in just a moment. And Luke Cage, I don't want to sell Luke Cage short. Luke is great here. Bendis writes Luke Cage tremendously well.
Yes.
And Luke is instantly, again, an interesting character because he doesn't talk like every other old white superhero talks.
Yes. So. And you know, again, we're really supposed to be talking about the first volume here, but if you wanted to sum up in one character why I love the Bendis Avengers run so much, it's best summed up in Luke Cage, because Bendis takes a character in Luke Cage who, let's face it, for the majority of his publishing history has kind of been treated as a one-note joke rooted in the days of blaxploitation. and takes him from the pages of Alias through the Pulse into New Avengers and evolves that character in a way that feels authentic and real and does not lose the core of what makes the character appealing in the first place. It is an outstanding job of character overhaul by Brian Michael Bendis. And Luke Cage, I think without question, of all the New Avengers, is the one who grows the most and whose profile is raised the most over the course of this run. As you will see, even here in these early pages,
yeah,
Luke Cage is being offered a chance at a newfound responsibility that he's never really had before, and he is here to step up to that challenge for the first time really in his life and willing to take that on. You know, Luke at this time is really a character who is all about embracing responsibility rather than running from it, whether that be the responsibility of being a soon-to-be father, or whether that's the responsibility of being an Avenger, which is a big deal to him, and he's honored by it, and which we actually see the scene in this book of Cap offering Luke membership and get to see how he responds, which is really cool.
Luke also gets one of the best scenes in the first issue, mm-hmm. and one of the best scenes in the third issue.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first issue, that scene that I'm referring to is when he sees the Purple Man in the raft, locked, and he didn't know he was going to be there. And it's all done visually. There's no real dialogue between the two at that point. There are just shots of close-ups of their faces as they look at each other. And that's on David Finch, who illustrates that marvelously. And I felt the tension in that scene. Like when Luke, because you've told me about what happens with the Purple Man and Jessica Jones in the comics.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that the sort of context of that glance between the two of them, and it made me tense up. And then, of course, the other scene is in issue 3, where it's shown how the cliffhanger of issue 2 is resolved, with Luke Cage and the Purple Man, and Luke Cage just beating the fire out of the Purple Man.
Yes.
Beating him mercilessly. Not unlike that scene in Hush when Batman unloads on the Joker, if you recall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful. It's a wonderful scene. And again, David Finch does a great job there. But on the other end of pet characters, there lies another character. And his name is the Sentry. We don't get much of him in this opening arc. He's the focus, as I understand it, of the second arc. But in these first six issues, which we're reviewing here, that are collected together, we do see the Sentry, the introduction of the Sentry in these in this story arc, and he ends up being the deciding factor in the breakout as he flies out into the sky and rips Carnage in half. But who is the Sentry, many people may be asking. The Sentry...
That's a great question. I'm still not entirely sure.
I'm not entirely sure myself. The Sentry existed before New Avengers. He was created by Devin Grayson and someone else. And yet, he was a very minor character. He was somebody that was largely forgotten. Bendis took him, wanted to do something with him, and introduced him as somebody who had... killed his wife and committed himself to the raft willingly, according to what we're told by Jessica Drew, all this through exposition. We're also told that this guy, who many people had never heard of, who had only been used sparingly, was, and it's said in here, perhaps the most powerful being on planet Earth. Miraculously, just never mentioned for decades.
He was there all along.
He was there all along. And he flies out into space and rips Carnage in half, and that's all we see of him here.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really – I know what comes later to a degree, but I can't mm-hmm. – if I were just to judge based on what we see here, I would say, well, there is an intriguing story you could tell there. The problem is it's hard to buy it in Marvel, which has a consistent continuity for decades, you know? Mm-hmm. I just can't buy that he's the most powerful being in the Marvel universe or whatever, or on Earth, when we've seen the Hulk and we've seen Thor for decades. So I didn't buy the Sentry here. Now you come at it from you're not nearly as low on the Sentry as a lot of people are, but what are your thoughts on the Sentry, especially in this story?
In this story, I mean, I don't really see how you can have a problem with him because he's barely in it. Like he's really, like you said, that one scene and then he kind of takes off and you're like, oh, we'll probably see him again. And you do. And I will say the initial, like Bendis written Sentry story is actually pretty good. It's everything that happens after that that kind of is where things go off the rails, like the cheesy Rocky III ending to World War Hulk.
To World War Hulk, yes. Yeah,
where they literally pummel each other into submission. Oh, so stupid. But yeah, so like the Sentry as he will be is not necessarily reflected as he is in these pages. So I have no issue with him in this story.
One of the other things that is a big part of this story is issue 2, which sees Cap kind of doing that Cap thing, or what we saw in the Justice League movie with Batman, the recruitment drive, right?
Yeah.
So Cap has to go around, and he's trying to recruit these people to the team that he worked with in the first issue during the breakout. So he goes and he recruits some people that are very willing and open. Luke Cage instantly says yes. Jessica Drew doesn't take a whole lot of talking into it. And then he goes and he talks to Spider-Man, and it takes a lot to get Peter to do it. He finally talks him into it. He has to talk Tony into it, and that's tough to do. And then he gets flat out turned down. He gets rejected by Daredevil because Matt Murdock helps them in the first issue. And when Cap goes and invites him to join the team, and actually, I believe this may happen in issue 3 rather than issue 2. I think I was mistaken on 2. I think it's in 3. He goes and invites Daredevil, and Daredevil turns him down and says, no, I'm not joining the team. And shocking to me, Daredevil doesn't join the team by the end of this story anyway.
For some time. Not until very near the end of Bendis' Avengers run.
I really appreciated that. I thought that added a layer of realism. It added some intrigue to buying Daredevil's solo book, which was also being written by Bendis at that time, because Daredevil is alluding to all this personal trouble that he's going through that wouldn't give him time to be in the Avengers. And it made me think, well, I wonder what's going on for Daredevil right now. I'd kind of like to read that and see what he's doing.
And it's awesome, for the record.
So I thought that whole thing was masterful, the recruitment drive, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, what were your thoughts on that recruitment drive? That's a big part of this story. It kind of swings it to the second half when we get their first real mission.
Absolutely. So you recall when the announcement came down that Bendis was leaving Marvel to join DC, and I had something of a concern because I said, of all the characters that I believe Bendis's voice fits, I'm not really sure that it fits Superman. And I guess I had done a poor job of remembering how well he really writes Captain America. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that Superman and Captain America are identical characters by any stretch of the imagination, but they do share some similarities. And rereading this reminded me of how good of a Cap writer he was. And now has me even more excited to finally catch up one day on his Superman run, you know, even was before. So, and framing the recruitment drive through the eyes of Cap makes perfect sense, as you said, for who Cap is as a character. Each of the characters that he does recruit, I like all of those scenes. The Tony Stark one, again, we have to reiterate, pre-2008, everyone must remember that. Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark was not a thing yet. And thus, Tony Stark is – they were leaning very heavily at this time into the futurist take on Tony Stark, where he was constantly seeing, you know, 7-8 moves down the chessboard for every action that was taken. And that's a great idea to kind of pitch somebody in an elevator. It's not a very interesting thing to read as a character in dialogue and conversation.
Because instead of having interesting things to say, he just says tech stuff.
Yes.
Like, well, hey, the Stark helicarrier 9000 has a 3x3 engine or something like that. It's just very boring. it's reinforcing my thoughts on Iron Man when I was a kid, which is that he's really boring most of the time.
Yeah.
But
yeah. All that being said, the recruitment drive, love it, especially the Luke Cage and Spider-Man ones.
Mm-hmm. And Cap is you. I'm glad you brought up Cap because I want to draw a dichotomy. Tony Stark, you could say, well, his Cap isn't dynamic. He's not got a great sense of humor, but Cap's not supposed to. Like
right.
When I put it to you when we were talking on the phone. When I was reading this dialogue, I could read Cap easily as Chris Evans. I was hearing his voice in my head delivering all these lines. It was great. I could not hear Robert Downey Jr. or anyone other than the generic cartoon
1994
voice.
Iron Man animated series guy.
Reading all of Tony's lines.
Yeah.
So Tony is kind of the weak link on this team for me, at least in the early going. But all that being said,
like down the road, this is the first book to really highlight the Tony Stark Peter Parker relationship that will eventually become something akin to like a big brother little brother type thing, more so than a father son thing as we've seen in the MCU, and it eventually winds up becoming one of the better aspects of the book, almost in spite of how uninteresting Tony Stark is as a character.
Well, one of the kind of shocking twists as this story goes along, mm-hmm. at least if you don't know that it's coming, is they go to the Savage Land to pursue the guy that's kind of the mastermind of all this.
Sauron,
it's all about
right?
Sauron.
Yep.
Sauron, yes, one of the early X-Men foes and early Avengers foe as well, I believe. And somebody that certainly if you watch the X-Men cartoon from the 90s, you'd be familiar with. So they go to the Savage Land to track him down, and while they're there, they encounter Wolverine, who has also come to track him down. And this leads to some classic miscommunications and all that. But eventually, by the end of the book, Wolverine is invited to join the Avengers. Now, it's left open-ended as to what happens, but as we know from looking at the cover of the next issue right now, he does join the Avengers. Mm-hmm. These new Avengers, and that's sort of your last piece of the puzzle. Tony even refers to him. He's like he says that Wolverine, the new Avengers, Captain America, because in that initial group of Avengers, they were missing something, and then they discovered Cap, and he was that missing ingredient. And in this case, Wolverine is that missing ingredient. And Tony said, and the way they lay it out is perfect because they establish a conflict between Cap and Wolverine in that Wolverine doesn't think twice before killing one of his opponents. Cap is adamantly opposed to that, and Tony says, we need someone like Wolverine on the team that will make a decision that we're not willing to make. After what happened with Wanda, with the disassembled situation, they need somebody that's willing to make the tough decisions that they're not willing to make and to call them out on it. And there's an issue with that to a degree for me, but it's just me as the way I am as a fan. Nothing to do with the writing. That was great. And so now you've got the team, and there's a couple of things about that I want to talk about with Wolverine joining the Avengers that are weird, but can't deny that Bendis writes a good Wolverine.
He does, yeah.
He writes a good Wolverine, and his dialogue with the other Avengers is really good. I've told you, Nick, one of my favorite relationships in Marvel is Wolverine and Spider-Man. I've always loved pretty much any time they interact in a medium. But, so that's our final new Avengers team as of the end of the story arc is Cap, Iron Man, Luke, Spider-Woman, Spider-Man, and Wolverine. And, of course, they run afoul of Sauron, who uses his cool hypnosis powers, and they come across as Mr. Sinister used to bemoan on the animated series, my mutates! And they come across various mutates in the Savage Land and also run afoul of S.H.I.E.L.D. and a character I had never heard of called Yelena Belova, the second Black Widow. What can you tell me about Yelena Belova, Nick?
Not much. I'm not very well versed in the ways of Yelena Belova. She's here. She's in this story. And I'll be honest, I had forgotten her involvement until brushing back up here.
Well, she seems nefarious.
Yes,
and they're not doing nice things. Somebody in S.H.I.E.L.D.'s in on it. Maria Hill is like, good Lord, could she be any different from her movie version? She comes off like
Maria Hill is grade A bitch. Yes, okay. So the idea behind Maria Hill, as I recall anyway, was that part of the problem the S.H.I.E.L.D. intelligentsia thought anyway, was that Nick Fury had developed too close a relationship with the superhero community, that he was too buddy-buddy with them and was allowing them to call too many of the shots and not really maintaining a strong control anymore. And so they kind of went with Maria Hill, who was going to establish a more independent relationship between S.H.I.E.L.D. and the superhero community. And she did that by pissing off everyone she ever came in contact with.
Yeah, she's just completely unlikable here. Just a grade-A bitch. And, yeah, so we come across her, and I got to say, man, this was we'll say our final thoughts on it, but all this team-building stuff was great.
Yes.
I do want to talk about a couple of things that didn't work for me. I already mentioned Iron Man.
One thing we should touch on, though, art. We haven't really talked about that. David Finch is awesome.
Brilliant. Yeah, he's a great, great artist. There are a couple of panels here and there that are funny, unintentionally funny. Like there's one that I sent to you in the group of Cap that looks like Gary Busey becomes Captain America. but other than that, everybody's got those occasionally. And other than that, the art is great here. Like the storytelling is great. The close-ups of the characters are badass. It's a very Jim Lee inspired style. Big fan of David Finch's artwork here. The other thing about this, reading these issues, you can tell the era that it comes from, if that makes sense. Because mm-hmm. for whatever reason, comics in 2005 were, I don't know if it's the coloration, I don't know if it's the inks that they were using, but everything's kind of dark to me, right? Everything looks like a little bit dark in terms of the way it's drawn. I don't mean thematically, I just mean in terms of the way that it's, the visuals of it. Maybe it's heavier inks. I don't know what was going on at the time, but it's of its time for sure from that standpoint. But the art is wonderful, wonderful art. And Finch, of course, would go on from here to do plenty of high-profile assignments, whether it be Batman, whether it be Wonder Woman, Justice League, plenty of big assignments for David Finch in the future for DC and for Marvel as well. But yeah, so a couple of things that maybe didn't work as well for me. Electro is not the most exciting villain in the world, but I was invested in him a little bit. I didn't really understand the plot subplot with the girl that he was interested in. Did that go anywhere, Nick?
No. Electro was simply a pawn in this game and kind of had his life screwed up as a result.
One of the other things there wasn't a lot here that I didn't like. I liked most of this story, actually. So spoiler alert, I actually like this adventure story. But so I talked about the pet character thing. I am totally fine with Jessica, and maybe she's this powerful and I just don't know it. But it was awful hard for me to buy Wolverine getting the jump on Jessica Drew and her overpowering him, throwing him over her shoulder to the ground, and then taking his own arm and stabbing him in the throat with his own claws. It was hard for me to buy that for a couple of reasons. Number one, that Wolverine, one of the most effective hunters and, you know, savage hand-to-hand combatants in the Marvel Universe, would be that quickly overpowered by someone who he got the jump on that wasn't the Hulk or Thor or She-Hulk. But also the fact that Wolverine wouldn't be smart enough to just retract his claws before they stab him in the throat. Very bizarre sequence here, Nick. Do you agree?
It was weird, but I'm not as, you know, I'm not as protective of Wolverine as you are, so I guess it didn't rub me the way it did you.
It struck me as awkward. The other awkward thing, and this is one thing that I think is kind of unavoidable for me, I just don't view Wolverine as an Avenger.
Here we go. Okay.
So this is kind of the weird part to me. And I didn't like how they kind of hand wave it away at the end, because Cap's like, Iron Man says to Cap, Cap says to Iron Man, he can't join the team, he's an X-Man. And then Tony's like, he can be in both. No, he can't be in both. He shouldn't be in both.
Why not?
He should be in one or the other. Overexposure. A, it's overexposing the character. B, how is he going to have time to have his own adventures to help the X-Men who are constantly doing stuff and to help the new Avengers?
because comics.
I don't like it. I never have bought that. It's hard enough to swallow Wolverine in a team environment in the X-Men, but that's been earned over the course of decades. Now I'm supposed to swallow him in a team with, you know, taking orders from Captain America and working alongside Iron Man and Spider-Man and all these other people. It's not a natural fit. And I love Wolverine. Wolverine's my favorite Marvel character, as you know. And I get why they put him in here, because at this time, Wolverine was one of the two most popular Marvel characters. But that's something that I think is going to be a tough sell. And certainly, they don't do much to sell it here. You have to see it going forward. But I didn't like that hand-waving of it, and I didn't – and but it's not really the hand-waving of it. That didn't bother me as much as just the idea of it. And it's going to be hard to win me over on Wolverine as an Avenger, I think. What your thought, your counter to that, Nick?
I have no real counter. I like the character of Wolverine, and thus I like having him here. I don't read – I've never read X-Men comics. So, you know, it's just one of those things that where if I can get some Wolverine – without having to take the X-Men with it, I view it as a net positive. So
I think to me it would be like adding the Punisher to the team in some ways. That's now, a more extreme.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's a pretty extreme example.
But even here, Cap is on Wolverine's case about trying to kill Sauron, which is pretty funny when Wolverine tries to kill Sauron, finds out that it didn't work, and then he apologizes for not killing him.
Yeah, and I guess my thing is Bendis writes the character well so that, like –
sure, he does.
And yeah. It adds something interesting to the team dynamic, which is the most important thing because, like you said, Avengers books, to us anyway, have so often had a feeling of sameness about them where all the characters look and sound and right. speak the same. And so throwing Wolverine in there adds another, you know, color on the wheel.
I think it's why my – of the traditional Avengers, my favorite characters were Hulk and Thor.
Because they talked differently.
Yeah.
Literally, they just spoke differently. I mean, that made such a difference. And Wolverine here is just used to provide a little bit more color to the team. A little bit more diversity in terms of personality. And that is what Bendis is here to do. He is not here to provide you with a classic Avengers lineup. He wants to do that banter and that witty repartee that he is known for, and he has to have varying personalities to do it. And Wolverine's certainly one of the strongest personalities in the Marvel Universe, so I was on board with it then. I'm still on board with it now.
And the other aspect of this that is more nothing really to do with this story, nothing really to do with Bendis, but just as an idea and how I am as a fan, and I know there will be people that will bristle at this idea. For me, I've never quite been able to comprehend why Captain America would be averse to killing. Because, and here's murder, yes, but he's a soldier. He was in World War II, one of the bloodiest conflicts in human history. Probably killed people there, at least saw his friends kill people there. And yet he's adamantly opposed in war situations to killing the enemy. That's kind of a weird dichotomy for me. Not that it's unprecedented for there to be pacifists in war, but pacifists that are leaders in the war that are, you know, I don't know. It's kind of a weird dichotomy for me, Nick. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's hard. Cap being a soldier and Cap being vehemently anti the very concept of Wolverine killing Sauron in battle is a weird thing for, and that, not singling that out, that's not a Brian Bendis thing. That is a comic book thing. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think the idea is that Cap has always viewed it as like, you know, do whatever you can to not. I think Cap,
right?
Like you said, he is a soldier, and undoubtedly he has killed in the past. But I think you can look at it a couple different ways. Some people choose to look at it as the horrific experiences of World War II have helped to shape his anti-killing philosophy because he never wants to see himself reduced to that base level of humanity that he was exposed to during that time again. And then also, like I said, he views it as, you know, those were drastic measures taken during drastic times, and that should only ever be taken in the most drastic of circumstances, that it should really be avoided at all costs.
Sorry, I dropped something. But yes, that makes sense. That makes sense. I thought he came in a little hard with the murderer accusations. Wolverine. But
later on, you will get awesome interplay between Cap and the Punisher in the pages of New Avengers during Civil War.
Very good. Very good. And speaking of very good, that's how I would describe this story.
Mm-hmm.
I can't go great. There were aspects of it, like I mentioned here, that bugged me. But on the whole, Preparation H feels good, and so does this story. This is probably my favorite Avengers story that we've read as part of the show. It maybe is that or the Ultimates 2, and I think I might have liked this a little bit more than Ultimates 2. It's pretty close between the two. And so, yeah, Nick, controversially perhaps, I'm a fan of the new Avengers so far.
I like it. I'm glad to hear it. I'm sure we will catch heat from, you know, longtime Avengers aficionados. You know the ones, such as certain managers, certain dark passengers, and certain former editorial director of digital medias. So, you know, we will see how it goes.
Yeah. I am interested to hear the feedback. I don't know how it goes. It may go way off the rails, but for an opening arc, gotta say,
I think the entire run is good. I think, you know, you and I have discussed Civil War before. I think reading New Avengers makes Civil War better because it provides so much context. So, you know, I'm biased. I'm a Bendis guy, but I think the entire run is very, very good.
And we talked about during our Earth's Mightiest Heroes podcast about the New Avengers episode of Earth's Mightiest Heroes and how I mentioned that I kind of like seeing this different lineup of characters that were maybe more up my alley traditionally as a kid and stuff. And while I didn't know who Luke Cage was when I was a kid, I didn't know who Jessica Drew was as a kid. There was a different Spider-Woman when I was a kid. But it was nice to see a little change up in the lineup and to see more high-profile characters like Spider-Man and Wolverine join the crew, mm-hmm. even though I have my issues with the Wolverine thing. He was still a nice addition from that standpoint. And they gave me a more – I knew what to expect going in. And they opened my eyes a little bit more to the characters like Cap and Luke, who was a new character to me at the time. And I'm a big fan of this sort of hodgepodge approach. Plus, maybe you hit on something too, that it's more of a – kind of a DC approach in some ways to the Justice League concept, although you do have your pet project lower characters thrown in there and mixed in as well. So
I believe it's Ben.
It was interesting.
I believe it's Ben who has described his take on the Bendis Avengers stuff is that it's an Avengers book for DC fans. I believe he's the one who's used that line on me before. So
that seems fair because this does feel more like a beginning of a classic Justice League story than what we've read with some of the Avengers books. So I'm a fan. I'm interested in seeing this. It'll be interesting perhaps at some point, maybe later this year or next year, to revisit this series and maybe do the next volume.
Mm-hmm. That's the Century volume, though, so prepare yourself for that. Actually, technically, if you're going by canon, there is a New Avengers Transformers crossover that is technically in canon that takes place in between this arc and
I refuse to accept that that's in canon.
It technically is, if you believe the dirt sheets and the rumor and innuendo.
Well, don't ever believe rumor and innuendo about us, because nope. we are coming back next week. We are going to give you this MCU finale you've all been waiting for. The Hard Travelers for Hire coming to an end. Mm-hmm. What will it be replaced by? Well, quite frankly, that's for us to say and you to find out at a later time.
For the foreseeable future, it'll be replaced by a series of theme months until we successfully figure out what we're going to do next. We've had some different ideas. We've mentioned, I think, different ideas on this airwaves. We haven't committed to those ideas fully. We've had other people suggest ideas. We don't know what we're going
to
do.
We have not conversed with Hollywood Hogan. We have talked to The Rock backstage, and he says you should keep listening to our show.
Absolutely. But with all that being said, Greg, I guess we're going to go ahead and wrap up the show. There's some time on the clock over there, right?
Oh my gosh, I do. I see it right now. Yes, it's time, ladies and gentlemen. Gosh, look at that. for the wrestling minute. Wow. AEW is ramping things up, Nick. They're getting ready for a big show this weekend. It's All or Nothing weekend. And, Nick, you and I have procured our tickets to Jacksonville, Florida, for the second big AEW event, Fight for the Fallen.
Yeah, it's Fight for the Fallen taking place, I believe, on the surface of the goddamn sun. You know, yes. Given the temperatures here in the South right now, what they're going to be in mid-July outside in Florida. But we'll cross that bridge when we get there.
When we get there. So to quote the great Brooks and Dunn, we'll burn that bridge when we get there.
I hope so. God almighty.
It's going to be a hot time on the old town tonight.
Yep.
But
wrestling fans and sweltering heat. What could possibly go wrong?
It does look like it's going to be a fun show. AEW, I would love to watch All or Nothing this weekend, but I ain't paying $50 for it.
Double or nothing.
All or Nothing, Double for Nothing. Double or Nothing.
Yeah, and neither one of us have ever watched a wrestling show using questionable means before.
No. I never do such a thing. Got to support our wrestlers. And speaking of supporting our wrestlers, we had a Money in the Bank pay-per-view event this week. Was quite good. Yes, delivered.
Yeah, it did. Women's match was pretty good, not great, but told a good story, had a good outcome, and led to a great moment later in the night with Bayley. Mm-hmm. So,
Bayley getting a little bit of redemption and getting some getting rebuilt very well over the course of the week.
Do you think at all it's a middle finger to Sasha?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
I think it's a way of them saying to Sasha, this could have been you.
Right.
So, and then I thought the men's Money in the Bank match was crazy, featuring just one of the most hellacious beatings that I can remember seeing in some time on to poor Finn Balor, as he just got thrown around and battered into ladders and tables and every manner of horrible instrument over the course of the match. I thought it was the best that Baron Corbin has looked in a match in his WWE tenure.
Were you angry online about the finish? The way most people were.
I was furious. I directly blamed Brock Lesnar for doing what he was told to do and going out and winning that match. It was his fault. And no, actually, I loved it. I think it's great. I think I was somewhat justified when Monday Night Raw came around and we got Brock Lesnar bopping along to the briefcase as if it were a boombox. I like it. I just think Brock adds intrigue to any show that he's on. I think Brock with the briefcase, or more specifically, Heyman with the briefcase. Let's be honest. Heyman with the briefcase creates intrigue, and Brock is such an insta-kill character that it adds a little bit of fright and legitimacy back to the briefcase that maybe has been missing the last couple of winners to a degree. I mean, Braun, yeah, but...
Braun lost.
Yeah, but Braun lost. So, you know, it's... I think this is a little bit of a redemption of the Money in the Bank concept. So I liked it. I liked the finish. I loved the match. I thought Randy Orton was funny on Twitter trying to start the hashtag #RandyTwoBumps. You know, it was a good match.
I agree. Good show.
Yep. Oh, and Daniel Bryan, AJ Styles and Seth Rollins tore the house down.
Oh, it was awesome.
Yep. Now, that's been the Wrestling Minute.
It has, and we're going to close our show, as we do each and every week, as you know, with a little musical number from good old WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. But, you know, normally I provide the musical selections for this show, but my understanding, Greg, is that given the news we discussed in the front half of the show, you were so excited that you requested to pick out a little something for old JR this week.
You know, I did, Nick, and I'm glad you mentioned that. I actually talked on the phone this – I don't know if I told you this. Mm-hmm. I actually put in a call this week from my corporate office.
Today, actually, as this news broke, right?
Yes. I put in a call to the offices in Stamford, Connecticut of Vincent Kennedy McMahon. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to him and I said, Mr. McMahon, sir, I'm just so excited about this thing. I'm so happy about an event that has just happened. And I don't know how to express that. There's a guy and he's, you know, he was writing this comic book and he's now not writing it anymore. And I need a song with which to express how I feel about this guy leaving this comic book. And Vince said to me, he said,
Well, pal, goddamn, why didn't you say something earlier? I have just the song for you.
And Vince sent me what he says is his favorite song of all time. Mm. So I contacted Mr. Ross, and Mr. Ross seemed agreeable to it. He said it wouldn't be the first time, apparently, that he sung this song. So
really?
Here to sing a little song, none other than Norman, Oklahoma's own good old J.R. Jim Ross.
Well, thank you very much, Nick and Greg. I really appreciate the time that you two have put into promoting me, promoting my products on your show. With that being said, this song goes out to one Tom King. Nah. Nah, nah, nah. Nah, 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 nah. Hey, hey, hey. Goodbye. No, he'll never love you the way that I love you. Because if he did, no, 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 don't get me wrong now. Don't get me wrong. He wouldn't make you cry. I'm not saying that. No one's saying that. Now, he might be the thrilling baby, but my love, that's right, my love, is so doggone willing. So kiss him. I want to see you kiss him, quite frankly. I want to see it. Go on and kiss him. Nah, nah, nah. Nah, nah, nah. Hey, 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 goodbye. That's right now. Nah, 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 nah. Nah, 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 hey, 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 goodbye. Listen to me now. He's never near you to comfort and cheer you. When all those sad tears are falling, baby, from your eyes, he might be thrilling, baby, but a my love, yes, my love, that's what I said, so God, so willing, so kiss him. I want to see you kiss him. I want to see your ass kiss him. Go on and kiss his ass. Goodbye. So, what do you say in that situation, folks? It's real simple. You say, nah, 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 hey, 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 bye. Hey, 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 goodbye. Nah, 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 hey, 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 goodbye. Nah, 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 hey, goodbye. Nah, 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 nah. Hey, 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 goodbye. Goodbye, na, 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 na. Hey, 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 goodbye. Goodbye, for God's sake, you son of a bitch. Goodbye.
Our traveling fanboys. Our traveling fanboys.